Thank you, gentlemen and guns, coming.
Hey guys, go. Oh, what's the point? You don't even listen to this part anyway. You probably just skipped ahead, not enjoying this little bit of artistic fingerprint I'm leaving on this podcast. You know what I'm saying. If you support me, just go to my website. I don't have advertisers. I don't do advertisers mostly because I don't feel like... I don't even enjoy doing this. You think I'd enjoy reading copy? I don't like reading copy about myself. Go to burtburtburt.com. Get a Burtcast coffee mug. Get a Burtcast shirt. Get a machine shirt. Buy my book. Live at the party. Check out my tour days. Tampa. Today's guest. This is why I do it. I gotta tell you who the guest is today. From Chelsea Lately, stand-up comedian. From Last Comic Standing, I think four? Three? He is one of Joey Diaz's best friends, and I've known him for a long time, and I finally got to sit down and hang out with him. And I'm being serious, this podcast probably could have gone on for another 3 hours, but we had to stop it. I don't remember why. Author, comedian, personality, father, Josh Wolf.
This is
the podcast. I set up the framing. She was like, I think the best shot would be from here. I go, I don't think I'm in the shot. She's like, no, but it shows him really good.
I mean,
you can hold it. You can hold it. Let me turn this damn TV off. Fucking greatest movie ever.
Look at this. I mean, this is quite a man cave, buddy.
Yeah, it's legit.
Did you?
No, I had nothing to fucking do with this.
You didn't. This was like this when you...
No. I manifested it. That's the only thing I did, is I manifested it.
Who put it together?
DIY.
Woo!
Yeah, DIY put it together. They paid for it. It's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. It easily is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me.
How did that happen?
That picture, it's kind of hidden behind the Johnny Walker, but it's that picture of me with the two guys.
Yeah.
That guy is, that's Josh Temple, and
yeah.
The other guy's Andy Singer, and they were at like one of the upfronts.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, sounds good, I think. Yeah, right. Talk?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Perfect. So, yeah, they were at one of the upfronts, and my wife is a firm believer in putting out what you want in life. Like, I used to be the kind of guy that would be like... I wanted a sitcom, but I didn't want to say it out loud.
Yeah.
So I was afraid that if I said it out loud and then I didn't get it, you'd think I was foolish.
Yes.
My wife's like, and I remember going to a party and my wife, the guy had said he wanted to be an actor and then he quit the business altogether. And it was a going away party. And I felt sad for him. And I was like, he failed. My wife's like, no, he didn't. He's transitioning his life. Like, that's the bravest thing he's doing, is allowing you to believe he failed and changing his decisions. And I was like, oh, fuck.
Whoa.
I did not see life like
no.
that. I was like, no, he failed.
He's taking his ball and going home, is what he's doing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she's like, no, it's the bravest thing in the world, because you're coming to his house and you're now looking at him like a failure. And he's saying, I'm cool with that, but I'm going somewhere else in life. And I was like, holy shit. So my wife said to me, you got to stop that shit. That's coward behavior. She's like, you're behaving like a coward. Tell everyone what you want. Say what you want, and it'll come to you. And I went, okay.
How long ago was this?
Probably. I know. Dude, you want to talk? You want to get like fucking... I'm one of those people that you can get me into some shit, and then I fucking believe it forever. It was 8 years ago. It was 8 years ago because Isla had just been born, and Isla's 8. And I took my goals of what I wanted in life.
Yeah.
I wanted to be one of the best comics working.
Yeah.
I wanted a TV show, and I wanted a book, and I wanted a movie. And I wrote my goals on our front door and taped them on our front door so that when you walked out of my house, you had to know that those were my goals. So that anyone that walked out of our fucking apartment saw my goals. My name is Bert Kreischer, and I want to be...
Right.
And so that I manifested the doubt. I said, I'll take it one step further. I'll paste them on our front door. So on our front door, when you walked out, were my goals of what I wanted in life, so that anyone that left my fucking house but knew what I wanted. And so...
I think my brother edited the trailer for your movie.
Really?
I think so. My brother edits trailers, right? And for DVDs.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know a comic... And I go, yeah, yeah, yeah. He goes, yeah, I'm editing his trailer right now.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fucking, it is the smallest world. I have another, I'll tell you off air. But, so yeah, so then, long story, very fucking, I feel like Brett Ernst, long story long. We bought this house, and this was a woodworking shop.
Yeah.
It was kind of attached to the garage a little bit, but the entrance was over there. And I didn't like the house. I mean, I like the house okay now, but like I really didn't like the house when I saw it. And Leanne, my wife's like, you can make this into a man cave. And I was like, yeah. She goes, you need to manifest that because you work at Travel Channel and they're attached to DIY. You need to bring that up in front of them. So I go to this up front. I walked right up to Andy Singer. I said, I want a man cave. He's like, what? And I go, I have the most beautiful spot for it. It could be really great. It'd be great for the show. I want a man cave. Oh, there's my wife. And so he said, done. And I was with Josh Temple. And Josh Temple, I had on my podcast, was like, what the fuck is that? Is that how life works? You want something? And so sure enough, they came out, they scouted it, and they were like, yep, this would be great. I told them what I wanted. I wanted this opened up to the backyard.
And they did all of it.
And they did all of it. And they did all of it.
Let me ask you a question. I'm you know, for me, 2015 is going to be like, I want it to be like a year of discovery and knowledge, mostly knowledge, okay? So I'm asking a lot of comics kind of the same question for me because I'm curious. When do you feel like your comedy clicked in? I know for me, like, but do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I use Bill Burr as a great example. You know, 6 years ago, he was always a funny guy, but 6 years ago, he became like a monster.
Well, I'll tell you Bill's trajectory because I started around the time when he was in New York and he had not found his voice.
Right.
I would say,
is it 6 years ago for him, you think?
12 years ago, he found his voice.
Right.
12 years ago, probably 12 years ago, Bill was, I think he was in LA, and he said, fuck it. Or he's back in New York, and he's like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing on stage. I'm changing my, I'm not being who I am.
What was he before
Brian Regan.
He was big and all over the place.
What's up with the fucking info commercials, man? And then fucking got the pan. I got the pan. I got the pan, pan, pan. I got the pan. It was real friendly.
Right.
And real approachable. And then I saw him on stage. It was me, my agent, and Barry Katz. They'd come down to watch me perform. And Bill was on stage. And Bill ripped it. And he was like, fuck women's rights. And I was like, holy shit. I remember pulling Bill aside. Not that I had anything.
Right,
I remember
just
pulling him aside and going, dude, whatever the fuck you're doing, keep doing that. That is, it is genius.
So he went more honest.
He went real honest. And then you're right. About 6 years ago, he turned a corner where Tom Segura pulled me aside and was like, have you seen Bill on stage? And I was like, no. He's like, it is fucking next level.
He took such a huge leap.
It seemed like everything that was coming out of his mouth was coming
crushing.
Perfect.
So that's what, and for me, what I'm trying to figure out, you know, because people don't give enough credit to, this is a craft. What? Not the podcast, but the stand-up is a craft.
100%.
Is a craft. And, you know, people, you know, and the way I kind of pointed out to people is like, look, you can find a 12-year-old that's even been nominated for an Oscar. You can find young actors who are brilliant. You can find actors even in their 20s who are good. Not too many good comics in your 20s. Would you agree with that?
100%. I don't think, I mean, to a point where it's like, I think you should just be relegated to working colleges. Because that's all you know about, and that's all you should be talking about.
Because you truly, to find someone who is, it's a myriad of things for me. Like, to find someone comfortable enough with themselves to truly be themselves on stage is tough to find in their 20s. And then to find that person who then can couple that with writing and all the techniques you need on stage is brutally difficult.
And to grow. I was thinking about you this morning because I was like, the first time I saw you do stand-up, I remember you said something about having a kid.
Yeah.
And I was like, I remember I was young. I don't know how old, long ago this must have been. Like, it was before I had kids.
Right.
It was at the Improv. It was before I had kids. And I remember thinking, he's my age and he has kids? Like, holy fuck. Like, oh my God. It blew me out of the water.
Right.
And I was like, and then now your kid's like fucking in a teenager.
Buddy, my oldest son just came back from Afghanistan.
How old's my oldest
son came back from Afghanistan. Okay, so from, you know, back then when you were talking about, you know, my deal was I was a single dad, right?
Yeah.
And I had met a woman who had two kids. We had a kid together. She developed a little bit of a habit. I kicked her out, but I kept all three kids. So the two oldest kids,
that's it,
were not mine biologically, but I've had them since they were 2 and 6 months.
Yeah.
You know? So,
and this is in, you're in Seattle.
This is when I was in Seattle, and then moved down here. And you know, that's how I met most comics, is that they babysat my kids when I was on stage. Because if I went to the improv,
yeah,
you know, you couldn't bring them into the showroom. And the comedy store, I didn't want them in that fucking place.
Holy fuck. All you'd get is a Pauly Shore. Yeah. You know the product that's made.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I didn't want them going in. But so they, that's how I met, you know, Joey Diaz babysat my kids for years.
He said Joey was telling me about that. He was like, my babysitter. He babysat his fucking kids.
Yeah, he was my babysitter. My daughter's favorite game when they, you know, Joey, not a big fan of underwear. And so when he used to bend over, I came home once and he bent over to pick up some stuff. And my daughter ripped some hair out of his ass crack. And she goes, how many? And he goes, oh, it felt like 5 that time. I go, that time? How many fucking times have you guys done this game? This is not a game I'm in favor of. And then she would sprinkle his ass hair on my fucking floor.
I remember seeing you on stage talking about, I think you were talking about being a single dad, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, he's in a different world. Then I got up on stage and everything I felt like I was talking about wasn't important. I was like, I was talking about like fucking getting pulled over. It seemed like everything I was talking about on stage was contrived as a comic's voice. So I think you're right. I think young, like, I remember doing Last Comic Standing 2, and I remember being like, I was like, I'm the shit. I'm amazing. And going on stage and watching everyone in that holding pen, and everyone had jokes very similar to mine. And I was like, I'm not writing enough, or I'm just writing exactly like everyone else.
You know what it is that I think when you're young, you write to what you think other people will think is funny.
Yes.
Okay. So even if you're writing about something like, say, Brian Regan, look, his stuff, what he's writing about isn't some groundbreaking, but it's true to him.
Yeah, very.
So that's the thing. Like, when your voice is true, you could be talking about the soles of your sneakers, if that's what you truly believe in, right? So your voice right now is like about as authentic as it gets.
Yeah, no, well, I don't know. I think I'm, I don't know. I don't want to.
Why? What do you feel like you feel like you're not bumping up against some stuff?
I feel like I just figured out, I say this to the guy, but and it sounds weird to say it on podcasts in general, but Rogan's been a very big influence on me being myself. He did a lot for me to find my voice, and I was fighting it. I was fighting it. Like, the machine story is the perfect example.
Right.
I didn't think that belonged on stage. That doesn't belong on stage. That's a story I tell friends. Same thing with the Tracy Morgan story. And yeah. Quite honestly, maybe that does not belong on stage. But Rogan's like, you're wrong. Fucking tell it on stage. Yeah. You're wrong. So I'm in Vietnam the other day, and he calls out of nowhere, and I'm on a fucking motorcycle, and I pull over, and I'm like, I feel like I'm on sabbatical. I don't know where I'm at creatively. I'm telling him I'm on a motorcycle in the rice fields of Vietnam, and he goes, talk about this on stage. Talk about these adventures you're having on stage. And I was like, I don't know. I don't think. And he goes, stop what you fucking think. Write it all down. Talk about it on stage. And I was like, okay, I think I just found my voice in that what is difficult to talk about on stage is now what I'm going to try to talk about. So I just was obsessed with killing.
But I don't know. Comedy has turned a corner a little bit.
It has.
Do you know what I mean? It's turned a corner a little bit. And podcasts has helped that. Helped, some people would say hurt. I know old school comics are like, where are all the punchlines?
Yeah.
Where are all your punchlines? But, you know, if people enjoy your podcast, right, they're going to come out because you're going to be funny on stage. But because they're used to your voice here, they don't need a punchline every fucking 10 seconds like they used to need. Yeah. If you're telling me a funny story, I'm in. If I'm a Burt fan, I'm in, man. I'm already in. Do you know what I mean? So those stories.
I think it's changed the dialogue between audience,
100%
fan or audiences and comics. I think you're 100% right about that. And I think now you look at like some comics that like you said, are married to this old way of thinking of this old, like setup punch.
Yeah.
And I just, like, I saw a guy who was doing setup punch, and I was like, that's exhausting as an audience member.
Like, and kind of boring.
Yeah. I'm like, holy shit, does this, like, it's almost like an ice skater doing one trick over and over and
yes.
over again.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'll tell you something else interesting about Rogan. I'm fascinated by that guy.
He is definitely worthy of an evening of YouTube obsession.
Dude, I am completely fascinated because you know what is fascinating to me? And I think in all of our DNA, we want it, but there are very few people who live it. He lives, and I don't know if this is the right word, completely free.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
In all aspects of his life, he lives, he does shit because he wants to do it. He does the entertainment that he wants to do, mm-hmm. and he drives that. And he lives the way he wants to live, under nobody's rules of conformity.
Yeah.
To be able to live completely free is, for me, is the life goal. And there's still some things that I feel that kind of weigh me down a little bit.
I have definitely a bunch right? of weights, yeah.
But he lives completely free. Do you think that?
100%. 100%.
I'm so jealous of the way he goes about it. And it's easy to go, well, I'm just going to do that. But it takes a lot of bravery to live completely free. It
takes a lot of bravery and a lot of willing. Well, you know, to play devil's advocate, he's, well, fuck it. I mean, I guess, you know, I'm trying to play devil's advocate, but I don't really have one.
Well, the devil's advocate, the one thing you could say is, well, he made enough money early on where he could kind of do a lot of shit. I get it. But still, there would be that, because
he had some unfree times where he was working with Andy Dick.
Yeah.
And put up with Andy Dick and was like, I'm fucking getting a paycheck.
Yeah. By the way, but he also got to work with Phil Hartman, so.
Dude, that was one that I've discovered that show right when I moved to New York.
How good?
I think it was on Annie, and I would watch it non-fuck. I watched every fucking episode.
From top to bottom, that show was and underrated, all-time underrated.
Hands down. And Andy Dick is absolutely brilliant on that show.
Stop it.
He is absolutely.
To me, that's, if you go all-time, underrated shows, that's up there. Taxi is up there.
Oh, yeah.
To me, Taxi, like, not to be listed in that top five or that top tier.
To this day, I think of when the phone rang and Jim Ignatowski answered it, and he goes, and it was the Dolphins.
Yeah.
And he goes, I'm talking to a porpoise. Those characters.
Yes.
What was I thinking last night? I was like, what if you had a character? I was, oh, God damn it. I hate when I have a...
Jim Ignatowski, when he took his driving test and he said, what does a yellow light mean? And they go, slow down. And he goes, what does... And they did it three times. That last one when he was going like this, what...
It almost makes me dislike Andy Kaufman that he didn't respect how great that show was.
I agree. I'm going to maybe be in the minority of comics when, you know, people are like, oh, Andy Kaufman. I look at that, whatever he was calling performance art. Okay. Once or twice, I get it.
It's interesting to learn about and go, oh, shut up. There was someone that did that?
Yeah.
Oh, that Mighty Mouse thing is pretty cool.
But if I had gone to a show and paid my money and he sat for an hour and read a newspaper, I'd have punched him in the throat. Do you know what I mean?
As an audience member, yeah. I don't think I would have appreciated it as yeah. much.
As a comic in the back of the room who can walk in and out and be like, oh, he's still doing that. Yeah. That's great. But as somebody who paid my money, I'd have been pretty fucking mad.
You watch Man in the Mirror and you Man in the Moon with Jim Carrey. Playing him.
Man, yeah.
And you see him totally disrespecting the show and not liking it.
Yes.
And I feel like saying, and even watching the movie, you're like, yeah, he's an artist, man. He doesn't subscribe to these. But I literally watched that TV show with my family, and I mean, I laughed
nonstop
out loud.
And look, there were other people on that show trying to make a living.
Yeah.
Oh, Mary Lou Renner, I'm going to go do her radio show.
Really?
Okay. So I looked at a picture of her. Right. She's gorgeous still, dude.
Seriously?
Gorgeous. She does her show in her house up in the hills for Sirius. And they were like, you want to drive up and do the show? And I was like, yeah, of course I do. I have so many questions for her.
Holy shit.
I cannot wait to get in there. But I saw a picture of her. She's still gorgeous. Gorgeous.
Do you know whose show I did? I hate even saying this because she's going to come and do my podcast. But I mean, I was like, I was like in love with in college is Jenny McCarthy.
Oh yeah.
And I did her show. Donnie Wahlberg's her husband. He was there.
Yeah.
Jenny McCarthy's still fucking as hot as she was in the '90s.
Jenny McCarthy lived in before she sold her house and moved to New York, basically in my backyard.
Really?
Like if I jump my fence, that's where she lived.
Really?
Yeah. And our semi neighbor. I get home late from doing sets and I go out and walk my dog, and my neighbor, when you walk up to his property line, he'll be out in his yard at 2 a.m. with one of those mining helmets on. So it's got the helmet planting cactus at like 2-3 a.m. He may have a meth problem. And,
definite meth. There are signs of meth, and late night activity is one of them.
Yeah, late night cactus planting outside with a mining helmet on. So when you walk to the edge of his property, he freezes. Like he pretends like you can't see him, and he turns off his mining helmet and freezes, like no movement. And then when you walk past his property, he'll turn the mining helmet on and start planting again.
Yeah.
So one night I told him, I go, you know, I see you. And he just froze. He's still frozen. I go, I know you're not moving right now. Like, I see you. And I was standing right in front of him with my dog, like as close as I am to you. And he was just frozen like this. I go, I see you. I can fucking see you. He wouldn't break character, dude. He just stayed frozen like this, plant with a cactus in his hand. I was like, oh, you are out of here. And then 2 days later, my wife walked into the house with holding a CD. I go, what is that? And she goes, you know the neighbor, the dude who plants cactus? I go, yeah. And she goes, I guess he's got a band, too. He wants us to listen to a couple of his songs.
Were they good?
The worst.
Oh.
He's like a 55-year-old dude with a ponytail who rides a moped around the neighborhood. And not one of the new like Vespas, like you know the one you used to have to pedal?
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he'll ride that around the neighborhood for like 30 minutes at a time, then go back and do his...
I definitely thought I would have had one of those by now. Like, if you had asked me in first grade...
The pedal one?
If you had asked me in first grade, hey, when you're your age... Like, I saw the movie The Kid with Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
Did you ever see that?
Yeah.
The kid, his 8-year-old self comes back to him. And I'm obsessed now with what my 8-year-old self would say to me right now. I think he'd be happy.
He'd be happy with this room.
He'd be very happy, but he'd be like, why don't we have motorcycles? Like, I thought we were going to get mopeds and motorcycles. We were into that, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, my wife won't let me. He's like, oh, shit. Decisions around here, buddy. It's me and you.
Did you always...
Who makes the money?
Did you always want a moped or a motorcycle?
I wanted a moped so fucking bad. When I was in first grade, I saw my first moped, and I was obsessed. I was like... And I had motorcycles. Like, Evel Knievel was like... I was obsessed with Evel
Come
Knievel.
On. Who, I'm not, but who wasn't when we were?
I wonder if... Dude. He's a fucking fascinating dude.
I have to tell you, I had a pedal motorcycle in high school.
Really?
I did. And not only did I have a pedal motorcycle, but I went out on a date with a deaf girl on the pedal motorcycle. This is a crazy. She was gorgeous. And, you know, I had stolen some booze from my parents and like put like 8 different types of booze in a mason jar and took her out on a date. And this was crazy. Like she asked me to, I go, well, what do you want to do on our date? And she was like, and I was like, a movie? I was so confused. I was like,
Wait, how is that going to be enjoyable at all? My friend's band's playing.
Yeah. I was like, but what I forgot, listen, this was a girl who was way out of my league looks wise, super smart. What I found out later, she did things on dates to fuck with people. Like the whole movie idea, she wasn't going to enjoy it.
Yeah.
But like we would watch the movie and at a weird place, she would just start laughing. And I'd be like, what am I? Am I missing something? She gave me, it was, you know, in high school, blowjobs, not too common.
Not too common. Hand jobs were my shit. Not that I gave them, but receiving them.
Yeah, yeah.
I was really good at hand jobs in high school.
She gave me, she went down on me, dude, and I, she was real toothy.
I've got to stop you right here. Uh-huh. I have always, because of The Miracle Worker and watching Helen Keller eat, I've always wondered what a blowjob from a deafblind chick would be like. Just fucking.
She wasn't blind.
Okay, yeah.
She was deaf. Here was the problem. She was a little toothy. And the problem with being toothy, I can't tell her.
Yeah.
So I was trying to squirm, but as squirming, I think she's probably thinking I'm killing it. Do you know what I mean? Because the more I squirmed and moved, like try to reposition,
the more teeth that go into
she
it.
Probably thought I was super like an,
oh, fuck.
I had to, not kidding, I had to grab her by the ears and pull her head back and go, no, no. Like she was a, like she just peed on the carpet. No, no.
Please, no.
No, no, not good. No.
My buddy Eddie got a handjob from a deaf chick behind a dumpster one time. And
there's so many good parts to that already.
And by the way, in the middle of you telling that story, I was like, we can totally light up deaf people on this podcast.
Yeah, because
like,
they can't hear it.
They're never going to hear it.
Nope.
Like, this is a safe.
It's a revelation for you, isn't
it's
it?
A, I,
the one the group this, that you can hit.
In the middle of this, I was like, I wonder if I have any deaf. And I was like, nope. I don't have fucking negative review. I didn't listen to it, but someone told me about it, and I'm not happy.
Someone brailled me a note. No, that's blind. My bad.
My Isla, my youngest one that was hiding under the desk when you came in here, this New Year's Eve, I was at the Irvine Improv.
Mm-hmm.
All our friends go down. We bring all the kids. We go to Newport. We get a couple hotel rooms. And the night of the show, everyone goes to my show and we get a babysitter. And Isla comes up to me like she's fucking found gold. And she's like, is it okay if I pretend to be deaf in front of the babysitter? And I was like, what? She was like, and it's the way her brain works. That way, if she thinks I'm deaf,
right,
maybe she'll let her guard down. And I'm like, not, she didn't say that, but that was the whole, that was her whole premise is, because I had told Georgia, we didn't know this babysitter, we hired her from an agency. And I was like, Georgia, have your cell phone on. And Isla's brain was like, I'll pretend to be deaf. And that way, when everyone leaves the room and she's just sitting there, maybe she'll like loosen up going, I'm going to fucking sell these kids and
that
I will hear it.
That is hilarious.
Isla's brain is fucking.
Did she do it?
No, no. Here's
a tough act to keep,
here's
by the way.
What happened the second she said that, I then said to everyone, because I thought it was so funny, I go, yeah, guys, Isla's going to pretend to be deaf. And this fucking one of the Eric Grusin's kid goes, oh, can I pretend to be German? I'm like, what? We're like, no, you can't pretend to be German. And then everyone picked what they pretended they wanted to be, and it was so fucking funny of them all. Oh no, then Isla goes, I'm going to be blind. I'm going to be blind. And then says, Tom, to my buddy Tom, can I borrow your sunglasses? And it was like overkill. It was fucking overkill.
Deaf would have been hard to keep up for an entire night.
Two girls pulled in high school, in college, told me and Brian Martinez that they were deaf at spring break. And there were two deaf girls.
Where'd you go to college?
Florida State. And we thought for some fucking reason, we thought South Padre Island would be amazing.
That's where I used to be. That's where I spring breaked in South Padre.
Well, if you'd been to South Padre, if you had been to like what Florida spring breaks were, like at Daytona, they were fucking chaos. South Padre, when we were there, it was all like Michigan State students. Like all the.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't what we thought it would be. It was like Michigan and Ohio. And like, in our opinion, Florida chicks were hotter than chicks from Ohio. Like,
I think that it's in everybody's opinion.
And so we got there and we were like, kind of like, and it was like everyone knew each other. We didn't know fucking anybody.
Right.
Like everyone was from the same, from different colleges.
So you, I'm assuming spring break in Florida was almost a year round occasion anyways.
Yes.
Tallahassee, especially.
Tallahassee was insane. We had spring weekends. We're just like, we'd do spring break on the weekend down at Panama City Beach. I forget. My brain's fucking fried. And they were fucking, I mean,
do you have
chaos.
One story? I have, for me, a South Padre story. Do you have one story that sticks out for you for spring breaks?
Wait, let me hear your story first.
My buddy was, okay, I like practical jokes.
Yeah.
But this night worked out better than any night could have possibly worked out. So my buddy was a bit of an asshole, a bit of a racist. And we just were not, you know, you ever think you know somebody in college, right? And then you go on, like 3 days in, we were like, we don't really like him.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Like you were like, I didn't know him as well, you know, just in passing. And he decided, he was like the eighth that we needed in the place to be able to afford it.
Yeah.
And we just did not like him. So I like funny and I'm certainly not a politically correct dude.
Yeah.
But there's a difference between that and racist.
Yeah. There's a difference. I will go as far as saying there's a difference between saying something racist and it being ironic and funny in the moment versus racist. Like,
Bert, I'm Jewish.
Yeah.
Listen, I would tell you right now also, I would rather have you flying a Nazi flag in the front yard. So then I go, well, I'm just not going to trick or treat there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I'm not going then to be somebody be like, hey, come in the house. And then when you leave, you're like a fucking Jew. Like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I would rather have the overt racism than the guessing game.
Yeah.
So, but this dude was like just racist. And by the second day, we were all like, this is, we're going to have to fuck with this guy. So my favorite spring break story is we took him out one night. We got him when ecstasy was still ecstasy. Yeah.
I remember that.
Do you remember that? When it was like...
I remember being in the back of a fucking Cherokee with Mike Osborne and me and him going, oh, I can get into this shit. Like, we were in the way, way back.
Oh, was that your first time?
First time. And I remember being like, I really like this. I was like, this is amazing.
Yes.
And then going and then finding other people in ecstasy and everyone was rubbing each other. And I was like, oh, shit, this is like 94, 95.
Yeah.
And no one was like, just make out in public the way they do these days.
No.
I mean, and I remember being like, this shit is fucking
But it
awesome.
Was good. It didn't have the speedy stuff. It was just like a
fucking breath of the angels every now and then just warming you up. Just,
yeah, yeah. You're like, oh, yeah. Hello.
Fucking love that shit.
I don't know that it exists anymore.
I can't. It can't. There's no way.
There's nothing that pure. I remember the first time I took it, I was in San Antonio. That's where I went to college. And my buddy was like, hey, you want to take some? And I go, yeah, yeah, I heard about it. And I go, what are we going to do? He goes, well, shoot pool for a little while until it kicks in. Well, you don't realize what you're doing.
Yeah.
But I was kind of caressing, just standing there watching him play pool, just kind of rubbing my hand up and down the pool stick. And he's like, I think it's time we get out of here now. Yeah. And I was like,
I think it's kicking.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, my fault. And that wasn't sexual at all. I was just the tactile sensation. It was nice.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, time for us to get out of here. Okay, so we're out. And this dude, we give him some ecstasy. And we get him in, get him really drunk and fucked up. And then we go home. And now there's a girl in the hotel where we're staying, three doors down. It's a room full of very large black women. And I said, here's what we're going to do. My buddy is going to get fucked up and he's going to pass out. I'm going to need you to come in at about 5 a.m. Just get naked and sleep next to him. And she was like, okay, why? I was like, oh, he's racist. He doesn't like black people. So he's going to think he slept with a very large black woman. And she was like, this is going to be funny. And I was like, all right. So then to add to it, what we did, and I don't know why, because I was fucked up, I decided that we put some peanut butter in his underwear. So I wanted him to wake up and think that he had sex with a big black woman. So applying the peanut butter to his asshole was super funny to me because I did it with a little fork.
Yeah.
And so when he wakes up, right, he wakes up, and we were all stayed up all night because we could not wait. All you hear from the other room is, what in the fuck? Oh, my God. I fucked a black girl. And then pause. And shit myself. And he came sprinting out of the room. He was like, nobody can tell my... He was like, his dad is going to find out. It was the best couple, 10 minutes of my life. And then we started cracking up. And she was like, I would never fuck you, you disgusting piece of shit. But it was a great, like... It was a great 10 minutes of him basically thinking his life was over as a racist.
I'm not a big practical joker. Maybe I am. I think I'm a little bit of a friendly bully, even to my kids. But like, and Mo Mandel told me this, and I forgot about it. And this may be to comics, one of the funniest things that I've ever done that I don't remember. But it's not what I did, it's how it turned out.
Uh-huh.
We did a show called Reality Bites Back. It was on Comedy Central. It was like 10 comics living in a house. Me, Theo Von, Amy Schumer.
By the way, Theo Von, hilarious guy.
He's even 10 times funnier not on stage.
I agree with you. You know, when he first started doing stand-up and he was writing jokes, and I told him, Theo, stop writing jokes. Go on stage and start talking, because you are fucking hilarious.
He is so... Chris Fairbanks, Amy... So like, Chris Fairbanks, Amy Schumer, and Theo Vaughn are all inside joke people. They love a good, like, inside joke that you can share. And I would hang out with them. But then there was also, like, Red Grant, Donnell Rollins... Like, the older kind of guys that I'm the same age as,
yeah,
that I hung out with, and Kyle Cease was on the show. Mo and Kyle.
The inspirational speaker, Kyle Cease?
Yes. So, we're playing poker one night, and this is when poker's real big.
Yeah.
And Kyle gets up and goes to the bathroom, and I go, guys, let's arrange it so that Kyle gets dealt a straight flush, like a royal straight flush.
Right.
And they're like, okay. And I go, and then we'll just, what we'll do is when he gets cards, we'll all just fold and not let him bet any of us. And so then he'll get
hilarious.
It, and he won't be able to, like, use it right. against us. So everyone's like, perfect, that's a great idea. So we range it so it's dealt, so that in the shot, when he deals, he will get that. So he gets cards, he deals, he looks at his cards, and we're all trying to hold a straight face, and he goes, oh my God, this is what I'm talking about. And he goes, this is a sign from God. I knew I'm in the right direction. Let me tell you something, guys. I've been in a really bad spot. And he starts looking at this. No. That's like the reason he jumped off the ledge. Schumer is fucking literally holding onto her chair. Fairbanks is frozen at the... Awesome. I got a pretty good hand. And Kyle goes, I didn't know if coming on doing this show was the right thing for me, but now I know that it is, and I'm spiritually in the right direction. And I, you know what, guys? I got to show you what I got. And he shows us the royal flush, and we're like, huh. And he's like, this is the greatest moment of my life. I mean, all these online poker classes I've been taking.
No.
I mean, oh, they're all paying off. And he goes, guys, I mean... And everyone's just...
No! Oh, did you tell him?
No, never told him.
Nobody told him?
Told him. Mo Mandel told me about it. I forgot about it, but I remember that moment, and I remember just being like, oh, I feel like a fucking heel.
Wait,
like,
is it your... Do you think you pushed him into the inspirational speaking...
No.
He's in... That's what he's doing now, I think.
Yes, it is. Yes. I think... I talked to him. I had him on my podcast. I think he... I don't fucking know.
Did he say why he took that turn? Was this before or after he went inspirational?
I don't. It was after. It was definitely after. I don't know. I think I really don't know. I'm not the kind of guy that on a podcast that can interview like tough questions.
Right.
Like, but I think the fucking stuff with Stanhope really fucked him up.
Yes.
And I think it felt like it didn't give him a leg in the community anymore, and I think that, I mean, he
I have to tell you, I think it's I think comics, it's an interesting community, because it's at one
God, you, I fucking, I'm never gonna be able to sync that up. All right, that's, I fucking, okay. I don't know.
All right.
I really don't, genuinely don't know, but
I will tell you what's interesting in our community is that one, We're it's a small community.
Yeah.
One misstep can fuck you up. One small, even disagreement, like especially now with YouTube. Now I don't, it can fuck you up for either a long time or for good. I mean, look what happened with Mencia. He went from a stadium in Houston to, he followed me into a club, and I was like, how are his tickets doing? And they were like, not good. I mean, that, now look, he made it, his misstep is the basically the one thing you don't do in our job.
I tell you what, the biggest sin in comedy is hubris, is people who believe their hype and,
yes,
and almost flash it up in the face of people.
Yep.
And I, because I think as comics, we expect you to be the exact same person when you're selling out theaters as the person who hosted for me at an open mic.
100%. You know what else I think, though? I also think as comics, we need to pull it back a little bit as far as our expectations for other comics. For me, you know, there, as long as you're getting on stage and not using other people's material, yep, but as long as you're getting on stage and making your audience laugh, I don't think it's up to any of us, even if you're telling knock-knock jokes.
Yeah.
It's not up to me. Just look, I toured with Larry the Cable Guy for a long time. You remember that set of punchline we were talking about?
Yeah.
That dude had 379 punchlines a set. We would count them, and he would remember every one of them like clockwork.
I could never do that. I used to think
it's an art form.
Yeah, I could never. No, I could never do it. Like, I could never remember that.
No. Shit. Either could I. But that's what I mean. Is like, and even things like, you know, people ask me the question I get all the time is because he's about Dane. You think Dane's funny? It's not where I think he's funny or not. I know as far as him being a performer, I challenge anybody to find someone who performs as well as that dude does on stage, and yeah, he kills it in front of his crowd. So it doesn't matter what I think.
When I first moved out here, I remember seeing him at the Laugh Factory and honestly being like, this guy's, it's like watching the first caveman make fire.
Yes.
And anyone that can say, I mean, I haven't seen his act in a while.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he's talking about.
Me neither.
And it's one of those things, and I think with Dane, you know, and I even am hesitant to talk about Dane because it always sounds like someone's shitting on Dane.
I'm not shitting on that dude at all.
But I think what happened is what we were talking about. I think he found his voice as a young comic.
Yeah.
And he wasn't necessarily talking about anything of importance. You know, it was like fun college tour stuff. And then life kind of jumped on top of him,
yep,
very quickly in a lot of different respects. And I think he was not connected to his material anymore. And he was like, how the fuck can I sit and talk about popsicles when, or whatever. Yeah, I'm not shitting on it, but like fucking finger puppets or, yep, you know, or I want to talk about fucking life because my mom died, my dad died in the same fucking year. My brother stole money from me.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks I'm a thief. Saturday Night Live is making fun of me. Like, or not Saturday Night Live, but Mad TV or whatever, right, that is making fun of me. Like, I can't do the thing I did. I need to do something real. Which, it's like one of those things. And I go back to this. It's when I saw you, you didn't have a lot of bullshit in your act. It was a lot of very real stuff. And I was like, fuck. Like, I was like, and everything I was talking about just didn't seem like it was important anymore.
You know what interesting, it was an interesting 3 minutes for me, and I remember what it was. Like, you know, I was single, I was raising three kids in one room, right? And so I remember I'm still, you know, when you say you're finding your voice.
Yeah.
For me, I am, like, about 2 years ago is also when that started to click in a little bit, a combination of things. But the honesty part happened in a 3 minute clip back when around that time you saw me, which was, I was talking about stupid shit too, but because I was raising three kids in a bedroom, I had a lot of real shit happening to me, and I couldn't afford therapy. So one night upstairs in the belly room at the Comedy Store, I just went 100% honest. I just needed some therapy, so it was cathartic.
Yeah.
But the shit I was talking about, for whatever reason, maybe it wasn't that funny. It was just like a strong opinion point of view hit. And I was like, oh, so it doesn't have to written on page be, oh, that's a great punchline. I'm sure there are some things you say on stage where if it was written on a page, you'd be like, that's not a great punchline. But on stage, because you deliver it with truth and honesty, it fucking kills, right?
There's people that like, there's an example of what you're talking about. This guy, Jay Snyder, is in Dayton.
Mm-hmm.
If you're ever in Dayton, tell Doc you want to work with him. He's one of the fucking nicest guys in the world, but he is really funny. But what's funnier about, it's like the Theo Von thing. What's funnier about him is sometimes the joke doesn't work, but that little part of the truth of it.
Yeah.
Like he's had a joke about doing cocaine, but the way where he grew up, they called it cocaine. And I go, dude, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Like, I know that it someone else would take that and abuse it, but the fact that you just slid it in there, that makes the joke real.
Yeah.
Like that, like him and his twin brother, he's got this story about getting arrested, knowing he's going to jail, and he had a tattoo, but he couldn't go to jail as himself. He has a twin brother. He needed to go to jail as his twin brother, because if it was him, he'd be going to jail for a while. And so he got, and so he had a tattoo, and he, and that was an identifying mark.
Yeah.
He went to a, he drank a ton of vodka because he knew he was going to jail in the morning, and he got the tattoo covered up so that it didn't look like his tattoo, so it would be his brother's. And he's, and he's like, I'm,
come on,
I'm, I could not make this up. And he's got the, and he grew up in a small town in West Virginia. And so he's got the tattoo covered up. He's drunk. He shows up to jail to register, and he doesn't remember any of it. All he knows is he's in it as his brother. And he wakes up in the morning, and his brother's in the cot next to him. And he goes, fucking, why didn't you tell me that? I came in as you last night. I mean, he is so, but, and like, but he can't, he's too young in stand-up to tell that story on stage, right? Because he doesn't get what the sizzle down what you need to hear in it. But like, he's got the most amazing, honest stories, but it's until you find your voice, it's so hard to get them out. I mean, that, me figuring out the machine story was a year of telling it on stage.
But you, but for people who, you know, I feel bad sometimes when I try a story on stage, right? That first night you try it, you feel bad for that crowd because you, I know, I think in my head, oh, a year from now, you guys would fucking love this.
I've said that. I said, guys, when this story works, you're going to say I was there when it didn't.
Yeah. But then let me ask you, as a comic, do you feel like when you go back into that city, even though they heard that story before, but they heard it a year ago when it wasn't as good, do you go back in and tell that story again?
Well, yeah. I mean,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yes.
Where is your, look, if I go back into a city, my goal is to have 20 to 30 minutes of new material when I go back in. Does that seem about right?
Yeah, I think so.
So, but if you're starting a joke around that time, do you reward them? Do you pay it off and bring it back?
Yes. Yes. Well, yes. Tosh said something to me one time. I was like, oh, he came out of the improv and I was like, dude, all new material and fucking genius. And he was like, yeah, I have to. I was like, what? And he goes, people come to see me. I have to do that. I was like, I mean, it makes me feel like I want to write. I need to write. And I don't think, and you know, Daniel sometimes can say things like a dick, but he doesn't mean it like a dick.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, you don't. He's like, no one knows who the fuck you are. Keep killing. Keep killing until they're all coming out to see you. Then start writing. He's like, I almost like dumbfounded that I would be like, I got to abandon what clearly is not working awesome because no one's fucking. and go for even more lukewarm shit. And so I was like, yeah, good point. And he's like, yeah, keep killing until then, until you're selling out like theaters. And
I hadn't thought of that.
And so I was like, that's interesting. But what you're saying is how I work, and that is I just get fucking bored.
Like, me too.
I couldn't do the same hour. I can't even do an hour. I do an hour 30. I mean, minimum, because I get on these tangents.
Do you do an hour 30 minimum every show?
On accident, yes. I always tell the club, I don't want to do more than an hour.
Right.
And then every time they're like, hour 25. And I'm like, I fucking thought I was,
and when,
so close to getting off.
When you go off the rails a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Is it always in the same area you're set? Do you start and end the same way?
No. There is no rhyme or reason to what I'm, sometimes I don't even, like, I don't know. My stand-up's fucking in a weird place where I love, right now I'm just writing a ton, but I love getting lost.
Yeah.
I love getting really lost on stage. And only thing I love more than that is getting so fucking vulnerable, it creeps people out. Like taking it.
Digging yourself a little bit of a hole.
Yeah. Like you said, like you, when you go, that one in the belly room, the 3 minutes of just pure honesty.
Yeah.
I love that. Like Isla's hilarious. I have like fucking 5 stories about Isla. I cannot just simply tell those stories. I have to tell them she's dyslexic, she's going to an occupational therapist, she's got some legit issues that we're working through as a family, because I feel like it's a disservice to, what's up, baby? Okay, come on in. I feel like it's a disservice to any parent who's got an original thinking kid that also has issues. You know what I mean?
But I think that goes back to what we were talking about.
That's Georgia.
Yeah. I like, she got a nice little close up.
Yeah. Did you look into the camera? Perfect, G. All right. George.
Hi.
George.
I think, though, that goes back to what you're saying, how the podcast is helping change the voice or the art form, right?
Yeah.
People are okay with that now. They would not have been okay with Bob Hope talking about how it's shriveled
up. I hit my kid every now and then. Yeah. another scotch up here.
I was telling a story the other night, and I was trying to figure out some... I'm with you. Like, I'll kind of... I write on stage. I'm not good at writing at a desk.
I have my notebook, and I will write down... Like, I wrote down fucking quicksand porn, because I was like, I feel like there should be a bit in there. And then I was like, and then I got into it writing it. And I was like, as I'm writing it down, I'm like, I almost talk myself out of the bit. I'm like, anyone's going to do a quicksand. Anyone can write this joke. It's not about me. And then I just stopped.
But here's the thing. Isn't it finding that line? And I'm asking that line between, like, you can write a joke about a topic that other people have an opinion about, as long as that opinion is uniquely you, right?
Yes. Yes.
Isn't that kind of the way to approach it? Or are you saying anything that's that broad, you would prefer to stay away from?
Well, like the whole Ferguson stuff.
Yep.
I was like, why even touch it? Bill Burr's going to have a point of view. Nick DiPaolo's going to have a point of view.
Right.
Norton's going to have a point of view. Like, all these guys that I really want to hear their comedy, they'll have a point of view. And quite honestly, my point of view is going to be somewhat fucking timid and coy and, like, not really have, like, a fucking teeth to it.
Right. Because
I'm afraid of having teeth and an opinion like that. Like, I do have shit to lose. So what the fuck am I fighting that battle? I go, nope. And then what I'll do is I'll just find a story in my life that is parallel to that. And during that time, and tell that story about me and what happened to me.
Right.
In these moments. Like,
but that's a different... I would tell you that, as far as... When you say Burr and Marr Norton, and Norton, when they tell their take on Ferguson, that's their version of vulnerability.
Yeah.
Your version is a little more personal, instead of what your opinions are. Yeah. You may not want to be as honest with your opinions, but you're fucking super honest about your life and your family.
I'm super honest about that. Right now, where I'm writing from, right now it is. It is just, I want to talk about my vulnerability and what I find to be, honest about me. And I want to tell that via stories.
I got to tell you, like, look, I just started, I did this weekend in San Francisco for the first time, and I didn't know how people would take it. I started because I don't like cats. I saw a cat in your yard.
I don't like cats either.
Not a big cat fan.
I don't like cats.
Let me tell you how much I hate cats. My youngest son thinks he's allergic to cats.
Yeah.
He's not. He's not allergic to cats. He's not. I told him real young on. He's like, can we get a cat? I'm like, you're allergic.
Oh, that's fucking genius. Oh, that's a fucking genius.
Okay, so I didn't know how to go about talking about
it. What's that called when the fucking mom feeds her son poison so that he can be sick so that... What is that called? Oh, that's fucking genius. What? I'm so jealous. I never thought of that.
Let me tell you. So I tried that this weekend because, I don't know, like you, when you write on stage, sometimes the first time you say it, there may not even be a punchline. You're just trying to get through.
The first time I say it, it's gold. The second time I say it, it's fucking gold.
Because you try to recreate
it? I'm like, what the fuck? It worked yesterday.
Do you ever try, you come up with something on the spot on stage and you're like, oh, that's going to be a great joke.
Yeah.
And there's something about that spontaneity and you're like, oh man, I just crushed that.
Yeah.
And you try the next night, you're like, and it never works again.
New Year's Eve, I had a joke that I told in Edmonton about, I just come back from Fiji to Edmonton, and I had a panic attack scuba diving. And a real legit hardcore panic attack.
Underwater you had it?
Fucking 80 feet underwater. And so
what do you do?
Exactly. Well, you just fucking, I haven't figured out the story perfectly,
right.
But when I told it in Edmonton, it was so honest and real and connective. And then I go up New Year's Eve, and the first show, none of that story worked as well, but I had this bit of what really makes you crazy when you're a person like me and probably like you who talk for a living and who like talking, and our gregariousness is part of it defines us as people. Well, when you're silent underwater and all you can hear is yourself breathing and the noise is just going, that's all you hear. And I was doing it on mic in Irvine, and it was destroying is this noise of like, and then I'm communicating with people with hand signs. Look, there's a ship in. I know. Yeah. I hear it. And then the second show, I tried to do it, and it was silent to me just going, arr, arr. And I was like, why the fuck didn't it work this time? And so there will be a number of times of me just breathing on stage before this fucking thing works. But yeah, the second time I tell it, I'm fucking, that's where it's lost.
How fucked up is it that, and I, this has happened to me too, when you're in some sort of panicky, life-threatening situation, in our brains, at one point it flashes across, oh, if I live, this is going to be a great bit.
Motorcycles. Motorcycles. Right? Going 80 miles down the fucking highway on a motorcycle, and all I'm thinking as I hold on to this machine that's hurtling me through fucking space and time is, if I live to talk about this, I can't wait to talk about the vulnerability these fucking beasts give you. Just this fucking machine. You're riding a robot racing down the... I was like, motherfucker.
By the way, a robot that, let's be honest, if you hit a bump in a weird way or a little patch of sand, which I understand there are out there, you're fucked. Yes?
God is just breathing on you. Just wind. A car comes by you and you just go, boom. I don't know who the fuck has the balls. You go to Sturgis, you see these guys in flip-flops on these Harleys just flying at like 90 miles down.
Do you go in between the cars?
Oh, no. No, I've only ridden motorcycles on TV, oddly enough. Like, I've only ridden them like when we're out on location.
Yeah.
Like, I rode a motorcycle through Vietnam. I rode one in Sturgis. I rode one through Alabama.
Is it a perfect job for you, the Travel Channel one?
It's the greatest fucking job in the world.
Is it perfect? Like, as far as for you, is that like, it's better than everything?
It's better than I ever thought it would be, only because it's changed me just exponentially in so many different ways. It's gotten me so much more comfortable with things I would have never fucking done.
Like what?
Rock climbing. Like, first time I ever went rock climbing, I froze at, like, 20 feet. And I was like, I can't go anymore. And I froze, and they had to, like, get me off the wall. And this is probably 4 or 5 years ago, 6 years ago. The other day, I'm in fucking Vietnam, and I climb up, you know, 80 feet on a rock and then hang out there for another 20 minutes while we wait to do our reveal. And I was like, man, I've changed a lot.
Has it broadened your horizons as a human being to see all those different countries and places and stuff like that?
Yes, and I'm not good with like fucking poetically saying things like that, but it changes you. It changes your consciousness. It changes you. It changes your DNA, because certain things. The first time I ever realized it happened was like for season one. It was a job. Like yeah. Season one of the show I'm doing now. It was a job, and quite honestly, I'd been taken out of the mix a little bit in the show, and I was just literally a host. They didn't want me doing the activities because my experience as a comic, we're much easier to talk about it. And I would overwhelm the couple when I would do the experience with them. I'd overwhelm their experience, and it would be more about them watching me do it than them doing it all. So I didn't all do right. it at all. So all I would, right. a lot of times I would walk up and I'd go, guys, today you're doing this. And then I'd walk away and I'd go and walk. I had got a pedometer and I'd just walk. I'd walk like 5 miles as I did it and then come back and I'd be like, all right, we're ready. And so season one, it was a job. And then towards season two, they wanted me to start doing some of the activities if I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay. And there were some that I really wanted to do. And I had one morning in Jamaica that I woke up and I had the most beautiful at the Jamaica Inn. I had the most beautiful room in the whole fucking place. I was on a peninsula out in the bay, and I had an infinity tub, a pool that was overlooking this, and I watched the sunrise and I had a cup of coffee, of Jamaican coffee, and I was naked and I'd showered and I was like, oh fuck, man. Like, and in my head I was like, I never thought I'd end up here. And I know that I hadn't earned it. I didn't pay for it. I wasn't a millionaire that this was mine. But I was like, I'm here. This is my job. And I was like, motherfucker. And I started really appreciating the show a lot in season two. I really started appreciating it. And then we had a big change of staff, and this guy Eric came on. And Eric, say he was, I mean, one of those guys that he really loved the travel. Like we spent the night at a yurt one night.
He loved the experience of the travel.
He really drank in experience.
Yeah,
and it fucking seeped in. I mean, one night we spent the night at a lighthouse out in Maine. And he was like, fuck yeah, I'm spending the night out there with you. He's like, dude, are you kidding me? We're sleeping on an island in a fucking lighthouse. And I was like, fuck yeah. And the next morning I was like, with the boat's like fucking 100 yards out in the bay in Maine and fucking in close to the winter. And I was like, I'm swimming out to the boat. And then that season changed it. And now this season has been, I mean, life altering. And I think also our executive Dale has been real instrumental in explaining to me what my responsibility is as a fucking human.
What is it?
You're getting opportunities that are fucking mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
Don't piss them away by getting drunk every night and staying at a Holiday Inn Express. Like, fucking wake up in the morning and seize the day and fucking be that guy in life, and then that'll seep into the show. And you'll realize that your travelers will feel that too. It'll trickle over to them. And he goes, and I think the show will be better. And he's like, I don't want you to be the guy, and I am the guy, that is scared of all this shit. He goes, but don't look at it like this cliff jump's going to kill me. Look at it like you're going to fucking make it through it. Be scared. Be real. Be all those things. But seize it. And so now I'm like, fuck it. We're going to Africa like 2 days, 3 days. And I was like, I want to do.
What are you supposed to be doing in Africa?
We're going swimming with great white sharks. We're paddle boarding with fucking crocodiles.
Now, you know, like I hosted a show, Shark Week, right?
I saw it. You took your shirt off. I remember when you ripped your shirt off, I was like, that is freedom. I was like,
can I tell you something?
I watched that every night.
That Shark Week show. Well, first of all, I swam with sharks, which was, as a Jew from the Northeast, you know, like, but when I say I'm not a good swimmer, I sink.
Yeah.
Like I can get out wet, you know, but so they were like, you're going to swim with sharks. I was like, that's cool. Because for me, as far as list of fears, as I've gotten older, like I don't want to live scared. I want to at least face them. And if I do it and I'm still like, I never want to do that again, then fine. At least I did it. So, I had never scuba'd before, and obviously I'd never swam with sharks before. So we go out in the middle of the ocean. We're shooting this for the show.
Yeah, where are you guys at?
We were in San Diego.
Okay.
And so we're getting there, and the guy gets to me. He goes, so, and I got my wetsuit on, and he goes, so, listen, you know the snorkeling, the couple of rules. I go, I've never snorkeled before. And he goes, he turn off the cameras? And they turn off the cameras, and he goes, he's never snorkeled before? And they're like, no. And he was like, can you bring out the extra waiver? Extra waiver.
Holy shit.
He said, I've only had 3 people in my 20 years sign the extra waiver, but you're going to have to sign it. And I go, what does that mean? He goes, it just means if something really bad happens to you, this is definitely not my fault.
Oh, fuck.
And I go, well, tell me the biggest problems. He goes, well, how are you as a swimmer? I go, not good. And he goes, here's what's going to happen.
I just love that. I can visualize that in the, like you are dead serious in a wetsuit.
Yes.
And he's on the corner of the boat. He goes, how are you swimming? You're like, not good.
Not good.
Like, you're like, I can fucking candy coat it, but I'm going to tell you, not good.
He goes, okay, here's, let's take away the sharks. Problem number one, we have a 15-pound weight tied to you because you're in a wetsuit, you're a little buoyant. We want you a little bit underwater so when the sharks come up, you can touch them. He goes, so outside of sharks, when I throw you in, you're going to sink, you're going to drown, you're going to die.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, say you survive that. And I was like, oh, geez. He goes, well, the trained person who jumps in with a snorkel blows the water out.
You're going to suck it in.
You're going to panic, and you're going to suck it in. You're going to drown, and you're going to say you're going to die.
Yeah.
That's problem number two. He goes, not a good swimmer, right? I go, no. He goes, problem number three. Even if you figure out that you have a 15-pound weight, and even if you figure out God knows how, that you know how to snorkel, if you're not a good swimmer, we're in the middle of the ocean. You got a 15-pound weight on you. That current is going to take you far, far away. Eventually, you're going to panic. You're going to sink. You're going to die.
Yeah.
And I was like, so the first three options, he was like, not good. He goes, option number four, I tie you to a rope, which is what they did. He goes, so you won't sink, but we're going to be chumming in the area. So if there is an emergency, you're bait. You're basically a piece of meat on the end of a line.
Yeah.
And even if you don't sink, the sharks are going to come. You're going to be in the middle of the chum. Something's going to take a bite at you. You're going to sink. You're going to die. And he was like, have I run through everything just so you know completely? And then the network person goes just like this. You've dealt with network people, right?
Yeah.
So you think we can get a shot or not?
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. Are we going to be able to get the shot? And then they just kicked me in the water. Sure enough, I sank like a fucking stone.
Yeah.
Somebody jumped in, pulled me up, and they tied me to a rope. And then they chummed, because the sharks weren't getting close enough, they chummed around my head do you know you're not supposed to do that?
Yeah.
The chum is supposed to be a ways away. They wanted to get a shot of a shark coming up to me. And the guy said to me, listen, here's a couple things you need to know about sharks. It's going to bump you before it attacks you. Don't let it bump you twice. If it bumps you the first time.
What are they, frat boys at a fucking if you bump it at one time, it's going to happen. But if it bumps you twice, we got a fucking problem.
That is it. Because it bumps you the first time to see if it if you're going to let it eat you. That's it. It nubs you. If it comes back and nubs you again, you're prey. On top of that, dude, I heard the craziest story from this dude. He's basically the biggest shark filmer in the entire world. And he was like, you know what I learned? If a great white swims at you, you got to swim right at it. And I was like,
What is it, a fucking bull?
I said, who's got the fucking presence of mind to do that?
Oh, shit.
He said, in the ocean, what swims right at a great white shark?
Fucking
nothing.
Nothing.
That's why. He goes, you have to act like a predator. He did it one time. He was
Did they have great whites out there when you went?
No. Okay. I don't know who's taking you on your great white expedition.
I've gone swimming with sharks out in Catalina 3 times. I've been...
Cage or no cage?
No cage.
What kind of sharks are out there?
Blue sharks. But a great white showed up, and I got out of the water, and my guy got out of the water, and he was like, it's a fucking great life experience. And then he got into the cage. We had a cage, but I was being a wildlife photographer for great white sharks out of the cage. That was my job.
Really?
Yeah. And so one actually showed up, and everyone's like, everyone in the fucking boat.
Yeah, they're massive, dude.
They're massive.
Holy shit.
And they move. I mean, this is something I thought of the time I saw it. All I could think, and I haven't really revised this statement other than they move with such intention. It is quicker in the water than a dog would be attacking you. It is so, I watched it. It darted. And I was like, oh, I'd always thought I could push one off. There's no pushing one off.
No.
Like, if it wants you, it gets you.
Here's the thing. You know, the great whites that attack in Santa Monica, and they did last year.
Yeah.
Those are, you know, if you've been in 4 feet of water in the Santa Monica Bay, you've been within 4 feet of a shark.
Oh, yeah.
100% guaranteed.
Yeah.
So they have great whites there, but they're juveniles, which is why people aren't dying, because they don't have the same jaw. But if a full-grown great white, so it's 2 tons. It's basically a bus coming straight underneath water at probably 50 miles an hour. With the most ferocious jaws outside of a crocodile in the world.
That's all I'm thinking of is
done.
You get in a cage, and why can't it break the cage? If it just decided to fucking bum rush the cage.
Let's go a little further. Why do all those cages have holes big enough for the fucking shark to put their head in? That's not a cage.
Yeah.
You know what? I asked that guy. I'm like, listen, just out of curiosity. He was like, well, you got to be careful when you're in the cage because a shark can get in. I'm like, then it's not a cage.
Yeah, it's called a hurt box.
Yeah.
That's not something I want to be in.
You're trapping yourself. The back is...
What kind of sharks did you swim with?
Makos and nurse.
Makos are fucking... They're badass motherfuckers.
But you know what? They're like little meth heads.
Yeah.
They scared the shit out of me. Those nurse sharks are big dummies, and I was okay with that. But those Makos scared to swim around. It scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
Dude, I was not... When I got out of the water... The guy who was chumming was like, we were not sure this was going to work. And I was like, what do you mean? Like the sharks were going to come? And they were like, no, that we were going to be pulling you up.
Holy shit.
Dude.
Yeah, I've gone swimming with sharks in Hawaii a bunch in the cage. I've been swimming with sharks a great deal.
They're amazing. Aren't they amazing?
They're amazing. It's my favorite. It is. I took my girls to do it in Hawaii. I brought my girls out. We got in a cage, me, my wife, and my two kids.
Yeah.
And I had a GoPro and I shot the whole thing.
Really?
How
close did they come?
Oh, they're fucking right up to the cage. They bump you.
What kind?
Galapagos. Oddly enough, Georgia said yesterday, I was talking to her and she goes, we're on a walk. And I said, yeah, I'm going swimming with great whites. And she goes, whoa, that I wouldn't do. She goes, Galapagos, I'm fine with. They're okay. And I was like, how do you remember the name of the shark we swam with? She was like, Dad, I swam with the shark. I'm never But Isla was so young, she still had to hold her nose when she went underwater.
Yeah.
And so she went underwater holding her nose and popped back up and is like, oh, and where's the shirt? I swam with sharks in the North Shore or whatever of Hawaii. Wears the shirt all the time. It's like one of their proudest fucking things.
It's amazing, dude. Why? Do you feel like one of the hugest perks of what we do? For me, look, my son is a huge sports fan.
Yeah.
To be able to provide him with those nice tickets every now and then, or to be able to meet one of his heroes, I never thought I would get such joy out of that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
to me, the biggest perk from my career is that is be able to. It's like this show for you.
Yeah.
My motto has been over the last 5 or 6 years is making memories. Right. If there's that extra, 10 years ago, I would have been so concerned. And look, $1,000 is a lot of money. But I started to think, all right, 10 years from now, am I really going to know where that $1,000 went? No. Dude. But am I going to make a memory? Yes. A memory that I will have forever. That $1,000, I don't know.
I piss away money. Like, yes. I end up pissing away money.
Yes.
And in my head, I'm like, I said this to my wife. We're out at the fucking fire. Her two friends are over. Her other friend's in London with her husband. Her husband's doing Mission Impossible 5. And they're over in London. They're living there for like a year.
Yeah.
And my wife's talking about going to London. She's like, I don't know. The money is the issue. And I went, no, it's not. We will never remember that $1,300 that it cost to fly there. We will never remember where that money went.
Agreed.
It will be gone.
Agreed.
We are going to spend it on Reese's peanut butter cups collectively or something.
10 dinners, 10 something. Dinners. Yeah.
But that memory of going to London with your two friends, you'll never forget that. And her two friends are like, fuck yeah. And all of them decided at that fire to all go to London. And it was the greatest time they've ever had. And I say that... I mean, right now, it's like I'm just – all I'm doing is making memories. And it's so funny, but it is the most – like when I am done working at Travel Channel, like everyone – hopefully I never will be. But
right.
When – everyone's run comes to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And when this ends, I will – the money will run out. But the fucking memories that I have from these experiences are fucking timeless. Like I will think back to things that – I go, and I always say that, like, I try to inspire people to travel whenever I do solo podcast. Like, I did one in Vietnam. I'm doing one in Africa. When I go to Africa, we're doing one out in the fucking, we go to a safari, and then I'll probably do another one in Cape Town.
Right.
You're so right about that, is that fuck the money. Not that the money's important, but the memories are fucking invaluable.
Yeah, and listen, it's different for everybody's level. So... For me, $1,000 is still it's $1,000. But if you take it down a level, and for you, that's the $100, and you can make a memory with $100.
Yeah.
I'm with you, man. I've been telling people the last couple of years, go make those fucking memories. You have to make the memories.
That piece of paper, that $100 bill piece of paper, the memory is so much more valuable than that piece of paper.
I could not agree with you. I've been trying to instill that a little bit with my kids. Just like, look, I don't want you out there, whatever you end up making or earning, blowing it on, whatever. But if you have a chance to do something with your buddies that you'll remember forever, fucking go do it. That's why my son, honestly, his 18th birthday is coming up. And I was like, you can pick what you want. Just pick something. And he was like, well, and I always told them, I won't buy you a car. Whatever you put in, I'll match. But I don't want to be, you're going to have to fucking know the worth of a car.
Yeah.
So for his 18th.
It's very valuable.
But he has a little bit of money saved up. I go, do you want to match it and get the car? Or do you want me to send you and three of your friends to Coachella for the weekend? Now he started to talk about the car. And I go, I just want to go ahead and throw this out at you. I don't really remember, or I remember what my first car was when I was in high school.
Yeah.
But I have no attachment to it. But I also remember a weekend trip that I took with my friends to see a show. We went and saw Hank Williams Jr. and Waylon Jennings.
Dude, I saw that tour at the fucking Sundome with my friends.
How good?
Fucking
how good?
Amazing.
How fucking good was that?
Dude, it was the best night, because right when he got done playing, huge fight broke out.
Dude.
I mean, it was fucking chaos.
So I go back and I told him the story. I go, my friends and I still talk about that fucking weekend. We still talk about shit that happened. You know what we don't talk about? The car that we drew in high school.
Yeah.
We're not driving. I was like, so I'm telling you right now,
yeah.
If I'm you, I take that, you and your three friends, I'll pay for you guys to go to Coachella. We'll get you, you can either tent, or I'll get you a little hotel room, and start making memories right fucking now. And that's what he's choosing.
I try, my thing now is when I got very drunk last night, so whatever memories I made last night, I don't remember.
I get super high.
I wish I could.
You're not a weed guy?
Yeah, I am, but not really.
Right.
Like, I don't have my license, so I'm kind of just like,
Still amateur status.
Yeah, well, yeah, that, and I just, it was like, well, I have a life insurance exam that came up.
Yeah.
So I quit, and not that I have it or would, but, you know, and then I just haven't smoked in a long time, so right. I was like, whatever. But I probably still would. I don't know, I'm on the fence about it. Like, I won't smoke on camera. Like, I would never do that. Like, mm-hmm. I would never smoke a joint on camera. Like,
what?
Because I saw you on Doug Love movie, or Doug Getting Doug with High.
Yeah.
I love Getting Doug with High. That is one of my favorite fucking podcasts ever. I could listen to it every...
But tell me why you wouldn't do it.
Two reasons. Number one, I probably have a morality clause at Travel Channel.
Okay.
That would negate that.
Okay.
So I would never do that, for one. And for two, I don't want to have the conversation with my kids. And I do, and I'm so fucking... They find everything I do online,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to have the conversation.
Okay, let me ask you a question then. So in 10 years from now, when they're adults and weed is legal everywhere,
yeah, I know,
right?
I don't know.
So in your brain, should it not be legal?
No. I think it should be legal, and 100%.
But then
I think it's better. I think it's better for you than alcohol.
Me too.
And I think quite honestly, it is. I wish I could incorporate it into my life more.
But even if you don't incorporate it into your life, right? And even if it's not something that you like to do, if just by going what you said, that it's better for you than weed, do you think the conversation you would have with your kids would help release them from that stigma that permeates a lot of...
I don't know. All I know is that I am not ready to have it with them today.
Right.
And so I don't know... You know, I don't, and so that's why, and when the first time, I remember the first time I ever got offered a joint on camera with someone, and I just didn't smoke. I didn't smoke because I don't think I smoked, or, right. You know, but I smoked a lot in college, and I smoked a lot, and it's, you know, and I've done a ton of drugs, but I just didn't do it. And then I said something to my wife, and my wife was like, I said something about everyone going, oh, yeah, on camera? Oh, good. That was a good call.
Yeah.
I don't want the girls to see that. What are you going to say to them? And I was like, oh, fuck, I never thought about that. And then the next time I was just like, no. And so then Doug asked me if I'd do Getting Doug with High. And
right.
I was like, by the way, I really want to do that show.
It's
like,
super fun.
I really want to do it because it is one of my favorite podcasts. Yeah. And I enjoy that podcast more than anything because there's no fucking anything.
You start smoking weed and just chatting it up.
And it's just,
yeah.
There's so much I fucking love about it. And he asked me if I do it. And I said, no, I can't. And he's like, Travel Channel. And I was like, oh, I mean, I don't think Getting Doug was High as on their radar.
Yeah.
I don't think they'd care one way or the other. I'm sure they might care. I don't know. I've never asked them. So I don't know. But I said, I didn't want to say it's my kids, because then it's the same question. It's like, but I, the thing is, I'm just not ready to have that conversation with them today. I know they're going to be, hopefully they don't use any drugs or alcohol in their lives and can enjoy a pure life. Now, they're my children. Isla, Joey Diaz said one time about Isla, dog, you're going to be knocking drugs and dicks out of her hands in high school. So Isla will definitely probably partake.
Drugs and dick.
Is dog, you're going to be knocking drugs and dicks out of that one's hands in high school.
Oh, my God.
Fucking, you're going to be knocking. Joey.
That was my babysitter, buddy.
He is so fucking, like, but they, like, Joey brought edible marijuana over last Easter.
Yeah.
Last Easter, brought edible marijuana over and gave some to my dad, unknowing my dad didn't know. And my dad was like, what?
Stop it.
I was like, and Joey's laughing hysterically. And I go, Dad, you just ate marijuana. And he's like, no, buddy, it's popcorn. I was like, no, it's marijuana, Dad.
And
I go,
Joey snuck weed to your dad?
I don't think Joey snuck it. I think Joey offered weed to my dad, thinking my dad knew what it was. And my dad took some, not thinking Joey just had a small bag of popcorn he wanted to share with my dad. Like, fucking Joey just had a small bag of popcorn he wanted to share with my dad.
Did your dad get high?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
higher than giraffe pussy.
Come on.
And I had to eat some too, because I was like, I can't let my dad go down the rabbit hole by himself.
Yeah.
I mean, edible marijuana, the reason it should be legal is just so someone can fucking regulate edible marijuana.
Oh, that's all I do is edibles. I don't even smoke it. I only eat edibles.
Really?
Only.
So do you have a certain,
yes,
like
thing that I buy.
What is it? Chibichus?
I buy the Chibichu. I'll buy the gummy bear that Joey likes. And then there's a chocolate bar that
goomies.
I like. The Goomies. I keep telling him, by the way, it's gummy. He's a goomy. I'm like, why are you changing the pronunciation now? Do you know, he's so, you know, when he was babysitting the kids, he would always like, you know, when people spell things in front of kids?
Yeah.
So he used to spell words wrong. Like he said to me once, it was my daughter's birthday, and he goes, hey, I put the candy in the D-R-A-W. And I go,
D-R-A-W.
I go, what? And he goes, the D-R-A-W. I go, well, I just don't know. He goes, it's in the draw. It's in the fucking draw. And I go, there's an E-R at the end of it. He goes, that's not how I say it. I go, yeah, but we all spell it the same way on purpose. You can say it.
So that we know what we're saying.
I go, you got to stick to the rules. I go, you can say it however you want, I guess. But
the same way on purpose, so that we know what word we're talking about. Yeah. He's coming over one night this week. You got to come over. I'm doing a late night podcast. My buddy Omar is an actor. He's in Eastbound and Down. He's who I was out with last night.
Uh-huh.
And Joey's going to come over. I want to introduce Joey and Omar. And I have a fourth mic. You should come over. We'll all get fucked up in the man cave. I mean, it may happen like tomorrow night or the next night. So if you're into it, I mean, Omar just got back from Paris and is like nominated for a bunch of shit from Ray Donovan.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so he's celebrating.
What is he playing Ray Donovan?
The Black Cookie.
Oh!
Yeah. Cookie?
Yeah.
All I know is that we were partying and I tweeted a picture, and then X-Pac, the professional wrestler, said, oh shit, Bert, you're hanging out with Cookie? And I know X-Pac from Tampa because, you know, it's like, I know X-Pac more from just partying than I do his professional wrestling career. And fucking Omar all of a sudden just goes, motherfucking X-Pac just treated me. Oh, shit. I remember Razor Ramon. It's fucking lost his shit. Omar's the guy in my book. I wrote the N-word. I didn't realize I wrote it, but I mean, I did.
Yeah.
And when I did the audiobook, I got to the word and I was like, oh, fuck. I can't say that in history.
Same thing happened in mine.
I can't use that word on audio. I can't be the Mark Twain.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck. So I called Omar. I go, hey, can you come over and read some of my audiobook? He's like, sure, I'll be there in 10 minutes. Comes over. I go, just a sentence. And he's like, you just had me come over and say the N-word. Yeah.
I have it in my book also, and I came up with the same thing. Because in my book, there is a story about this. I coached this T-ball team at Poinsettia Park in Hollywood, which was a bunch of misfits. But one of the misfits was this white Russian kid who thought he was black. And we played a basically all black team.
Yeah.
And so apparently when one kid, he played first base, and he liked to go by the name Poison Ivy. That was his black name.
Interesting.
So he said when the guy got in first place, N-word please, you know, he said something about, the kid said something, well, we're going to beat you. And the kid in the first baseman who thought he was black said, N-word please. So the black kid on first base starts screaming, he just called me an N-word.
Yeah.
He just called. So people just start fucking
Fucking chaos.
Chaos, dude.
Dude.
Chaos.
I've seen those. I do not get involved. I am competitive.
Yeah.
But meaning like I want the girls to win at softball, and I will not get involved in their softball because I see parents get involved.
Oh, they get...
My wife is like, that was a fucking ball. I go, honey, the ump doesn't have money on the game, okay?
And
he's just doing his best. Leave the fucking guy alone.
I tell people all the time, and when I was coaching, and I coached my youngest son's teams up until my career got good enough where...
You didn't have the time to do it.
Right, right. But I would tell parents, and they would yell at the ump. I go, hey, you know, he's 16 and he's making $10.
Yeah.
You want to hop in and replace him? Oh, you don't want to stand out in the heat in the valley for 8 hours calling balls and strikes for 8-year-olds? You don't want to do that? Then it's time to shut the fuck up.
Yeah. And the fucking dads, I mean, they're these dads that coach one of my kids' teams. Not George's, it's Isla's. These dads are like, this is why I kind of subtract myself. They don't know anything about the fundamentals of the game.
Yes.
And I grew up playing baseball, recruited to go play college, went to walk on at Florida State and realized very quickly I'm done with the sport and walked away from it. But I mean, when I was playing, I mean, I was all state catcher. I mean, I fucking
were you really?
Yeah, maybe all county, maybe all state's a little big. But I was like, I was a legit baseball player. I mean, I could have gone and played in college, and possibly, who knows? But
I played left field in college.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. So certain things that frustrate me are like when I watch them trying to teach these girls fundamentals that don't. They couldn't get the girls to follow through with their swings.
Yeah.
So and I'm like fucking sitting there, and then I'm like, can I just do this? Can I show you how to do it? And I go, come here, Elizabeth, take the bat. I go, throw it at the pitcher's mound. She goes, what? And I go, swing, but let go and try to throw it at the pitcher's mound. And she goes, okay. So she swings and throws the bats. I go, see what happened with your arms? I go, yeah. Do that again, but don't let go of the bat. And she follows through. And the guy's like, how did you fucking know that? And I go, because it's fucking fundamentals. That's how they fucking swing through a pitch. What? And I'm like, it drove me nuts. And Georgia would go out there and they'd fuck with Georgia's swing. I was like, don't fuck with my kid's swing. I play softball with her in the front yard. She has got a beast of a fucking swing.
Yeah.
Don't fuck with my kid's swing. Don't tell her where to hold the bat. Don't fucking tell her where to hold
the
bat.
I got this.
Yeah, where you think a bat should be held. That's where she wants to hold it, and that's where her swing's comfortable. Let her hold the fucking bat. Like, I lose my shit.
Dude, the worst part is this, and I had to tell people all the time, you know what your son isn't? Derek Jeter.
Yeah.
Not even fucking close. And I'll tell you something, I would tell him, I played baseball in college, so I was better than a lot of people I played with growing up.
Yeah.
So I realized he may be better than the other people. You know what he isn't? Anywhere close to a professional baseball player.
Yeah.
That is a level... When you see that, you can recognize that style of athlete.
The only reason I got recruited to do anything is I caught a guy named Brad Radke who pitched for the Twins. And so
you know what a professional player looks like.
I know what a professional player looks like when you're six.
Yes.
Because we played against Brad when we were six, and he hit a home run out of the park that was two leagues ahead. We were using their field. He hit it out of that park. No one was hitting home runs.
And he was a pitcher. He wasn't even the best hitter.
He'd come in to high school practices in the middle of basketball season in high tops, shorts, and a basketball jersey and drop bombs. And I was like, here I am. I've been focusing on baseball. First time I did stand-up, I didn't know how to use this analogy. The first time I did stand-up, I called my dad. And I said, do you remember when... watching Brad Radke play baseball when we were kids? And he was like, yep. I go, that's me in stand-up. I go, I feel like Brad must have felt in stand-up.
That's awesome.
It's very natural.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I think I found my thing. I was at Tallahassee. I did one open mic at a place called Pop Ellie's, and I called my dad when I got home. No cell phones. When I got home, I called my dad. He said, how'd it go? I said, remember watching Brad Radke play? I feel like I found my thing. I said, I feel
that's
very
amazing.
Natural with it, and I feel like sky's the limit. I remember the first time I did stand-up, there were like... four comics went on ahead of me. It was a radio station put it together. Uh-huh. They wanted me to fail. Four touring headliners in Florida
right.
go on before me. Each do 20 minutes at a bar gig. This is a bar gig.
Why were you last?
Because I was famous. I was famous, and so they were.
Why were you famous?
Rolling Stone magazine had discovered me and called me the number one party animal in the country. And it was like a 6.5-page article. It was fucking huge. Oliver Stone optioned the rights to my life. Like, it was a big fucking deal.
How do they decide that?
They just, honestly, they were just needed an article.
And so they were said, do you think the radio station was like, this motherfucker?
The radio station did, in fact, say, what we'll do is we'll put on a show. We'll all come out. It'll be at night. He'll fail miserably. We'll mock him, you know, on air, and we'll have we'll have material to talk about, and we'll get ticket sales. They got ticket sales. They put on a fucking stand-up comedy event, and
what year is this?
1997. It had to be 97. Yeah, and so I go at the end. It's amazing. Small details and stories. Oh, I'm obsessed with small details.
Yeah.
I remember the shirt I was wearing, and I remember one bit of advice I got from a guy. I grabbed a Miller Lite. Before, like, right when I got there.
Yeah.
And the guy literally, like, grabbed my hand and he goes, I'm not going to tell you anything about your life, but this, before you go on stage, turns into a really bad habit. And he goes, do it sober so that you can always do it sober. Because if you need this to get on stage, you're going to always need it.
I get the same advice.
Yep. And I fucking put it down and I didn't even drink it. I went, okay. And which is not my personality then.
Right.
I would have had to get hammered to do this.
Right.
went on stage, did 30 minutes of just stream of conscious, just kind of a little bit of what I do now on stage, but like just real stream of conscious, no material, just getting laughs, and I didn't know why I was getting laughs. And I did 30 minutes, and I killed, got off stage, radio station offered me my own morning show.
Stop it.
And yeah, the guy came up to me and said, that was fucking amazing. We want you to take over the morning show. And I went, what? And he goes, our lead guy is...
Were you still in college at the time?
I was still in college. He goes, our lead guy's leaving. We'd love for you to come in. You'll be his, you know, on-air co-host for a month. And at the end of the month, he's going to go move to New York, and it'll be your show.
Did you do that during classes?
Nope. I go over, I sat down with the guy, and I was like, so I heard, you know, we're going to be working together. And he's like, yeah, it'll be a month. It'll be fun. Come in, be yourself. It'll be fun. Then you can have the show. I said, where are you going? He said, New York. I said, man, why aren't you staying here? Like, this is like the greatest gig ever. You're in Tallahassee. You got your own morning show. You're making fucking probably 80 grand a year. In my head, that's $1 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he said, who the fuck wants to live in Tallahassee? And I was like, not me. I was like, I'm going to fucking fuck you. I'm going to New York too. So I moved to New York.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, fuck it.
You didn't take the job?
No. I called my dad that night, told him that, you know, this is my thing. And my dad was I didn't tell him I was going to, that I decided to go to New York. And then I went down to Naples. My uncle had a house in Naples. I went down and hung out with my uncle in Naples. And my uncle and I went out to chest deep water in Naples.
Yeah.
No fucking waves. Just had a glass of red wine filled to the top. And I told him, I said, I'm going to be a stand up. And he said, all right, I'll talk to your dad. I'll make sure your dad's cool with it.
That's awesome.
And he's like, and, you know, if you need any help, call me. You can always come down to Washington and stay with us. But and my uncle was like, you need to move to New York right now. So I fucking moved to New York.
Do you know the third time I ever did stand up, I opened for Kinison.
What?
Okay. The second time I ever did stand up, I was in San Antonio and I had won a
you grew up in Boston, right?
Yes.
Went school in San Antonio.
Trinity. Okay.
Really?
Yep.
Okay.
So the second time I ever did stand up, I won a comedy competition on St. Mary's Street at a place called Hugo's, right? And so it was just, and you know, back, you won a comedy competition because more of my friends went to watch. And right.
Yeah.
So on the way into San Antonio for Kinison was performing, Carla Bo's dad died of AIDS.
What?
On the way in. So he needed an opener. So they called ahead and they said, how are we going to find an opener? And the radio station was like, you know, there was just a comedy competition at Hugo's. Let's get the winner. So somebody called me in my dorm room and was like, hey, Sam Kinison wants you to open for him. And I was like,
shut the fuck up.
Boy, you know, the first thing I thought was, this comedy shit's easy, right? I'm fucking killing.
I got this dialed in.
Let me first tell you. So
I got this shit.
Yeah, I got it. I got a lockdown, right? Now, when you're young comic.
By the way, I had the exact same.
Yeah, I got it. I'm going to get it. This is easy.
How much does it pay?
Yeah. I'm going to need my own dressing room.
Yeah.
You know, and at that age, I was still, before I started worrying about material and how much time they wanted me to do, my first thought was, what am I going to wear that makes it look like I'm a comic?
Yep.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Okay.
I need New Balance sneakers.
Let me tell you what, can I tell you what I ended up on and then I'll tell you what the material? I had my acid wash jeans.
Yes.
I had a blue button-down Oxford tucked into those jeans.
Okay.
And I had a black motorcycle jacket that I wore over that with my hair in a ponytail.
It reads legit to me. I don't know why it doesn't read legit to anyone else.
I go on stage. Kinison is late. He was sober.
Yeah.
So his brother, Bill Kinison, was his manager. Mm-hmm. And he was like, hey, so we're going to... And this is... my comedy competition, guess how much material I had to win? 7 minutes.
Yeah.
The third.
Oh, fuck.
So he was like, listen, can you just do first show like 25? And I was like, third time I'm on stage. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Can you do the same 7 minutes? Can you do it three times?
I was thinking, what I was thinking was 7 minutes. First 5 minutes, like, how you doing? Where are you from? 7 minutes. Maybe then I'll ask if anybody has any questions.
Yeah. I'll stretch.
Yeah, and then at San Antonio, maybe I'll do the other 7 minutes in Spanish. Yeah. You know what I mean? I'll mix it up a little bit. It did not go that well, right? And listen, with someone like Kinison, those fans were rabid. I assume it's almost like with Rogan's fans, like rabid.
I've never,
right? So, yeah. But they could not wait for Sam to get on stage. That was basically it, right? So Sam does his first, and he's fucked up. And he doesn't get any less fucked up going to the second show.
Get any less fucked up.
So Bill says to me, hey, how much time do you have? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, you know, I don't know if Sam's going to be able to do that full hour. Is there any way you can plan on doing at least 35? And at 35, look over to me on the side of the stage.
We'll see where we're at. Motherfucker.
So let me tell you, his crowd was super polite. I was so bad, Bert. They didn't boo me. They just started talking amongst themselves.
They were oh, is he still up there? Okay.
That's what it was. They just started having conversations amongst themselves, completely ignoring me. Like, I was so bad, it wasn't even worth going, you suck. It was like nothing was in front of them. And I just sat on there, and I ended up doing, I think, 42 minutes. I bet 6 of that was comedy. 36 of it was you guys are not even listening to me. It was like terrible
stuff. So wait, what did what was the fourth time you went on stage like how did that what happens after that?
Okay, after that it seriously made me question. I get off stage, right, and I was like, what am I doing? I was performing like in front of a bar and from my friends, of course they,
yeah,
you know what I mean? And Bill Kinison was like, hey, he goes, thanks for doing that. And I was like, yeah. He goes, I know it was a little rough. And I go, a little rough. He goes, but you know what you did? You stood up there for 42 minutes.
You're like, it can't get worse than that.
Yeah. And he was like, listen, he was like, are you ready to do 42 minutes? No. He said, but you stood up there confident for 42 minutes. And he was like, you got something. So just keep doing it. And I was like, because I didn't quit. I didn't drop the mic. I didn't cry. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
And it was brutal, dude. Have you had something where it's brutal while you're on stage? You're like, oh man, like it's soul sucking because you want it so bad.
Yeah.
Right. It hurts at the deepest level. But that's also how I knew. I was like, I care enough where this really fucking, I don't want this to ever happen to me again.
John Beamer, was a guy I wrote about him in my book, but he's a guy that a guy I grew up with in Tampa. And when I moved to New York, I didn't know anybody, and I used to bring weed to bars and get people high at their place and then pass out on their couch. It was like kind of my angle.
I love that angle.
And so I only did it like twice, because the second night I did it, I passed out accidentally, not even knowing, on John Beamer's couch. Like,
yeah.
He woke up in the morning, he goes, Bert? And I was like, Beamer, what the fuck are you doing here? He's like, I'm going to be a comedian. And I was like, me too. And so me and him did our first open mic together. David J used to have an open mic at the Boston Comedy Club. And Dimitri Martin was on that show. John Beamer, myself, this guy, I wish I could remember this guy's name, but I'm sure he's a producer now. I'm sure. The guy was so smart. And John Beamer had gone to the Hamptons that weekend to work on material, or gone to the Shore to work on material, and then come back for that Monday night show. And he had his set memorized.
Really?
And I was like, I don't need to write material. When I get on stage, it comes out. So I had nothing fucking planned. And Beamer was like, that's not the way to go about it. Comics write it. And I was like, meh, well, not this one. And so Beamer goes on stage, and he goes, hey, he grabs the mic, and he's like, all right. Okay. Huh. Huh? And he freezes and he goes, I don't remember what I was supposed to say. And it gets a laugh because it's awkward.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he just goes, all right, good night. And he jumps off stage, and that gets a huge laugh because everyone's like, but he did it in real panic. Like,
right.
All right, good night, and got off stage. And then he jumped back on stage because it got a laugh. He goes, okay, I got it. Friends, what's up with that show? Oh, Jesus, it's happening. He goes, I can't remember what this is. All right, and then he gets off, and David J comes back, and David J goes, that might be the shortest career in show business I've ever seen. My buddy Eddie Fernandez, who's one of the funniest human beings, the guy that got a hand job from the Deaf Girl Behind the Dumpster,
yeah.
Eddie Fernandez sits down next to John Beamer and goes, and John Beamer is in like a death stare on like in the back of the room, and Eddie goes, you know what, though? It can't get worse than that. And John Beamer looks at him and goes, it can only get worse. and John Beamer moved back to Tampa. He's like, never, I'm done. Never done it again. He's now hilarious. He's now a doctor in Chicago. I ran into him at a fucking show. He's a doctor in Chicago.
Do you know the people that I started with? I guess the two people that you would know that I started with that I cut my teeth with were Joey and Brody.
Fucking Brody made me laugh harder than shit in New York. I used to love watching him do stand-up.
I was there the night. Okay, he walks off stage, right? And we were doing open mic at Comedy Underground, the old Comedy Underground.
Yeah.
And he goes to me, Steve Brody is not funny. And I go, what do you mean? And he goes, Steve Brody isn't funny. And I go, okay. And he goes, you know who is? I go, who? He goes, Brody Stevens. I go, who's that? And he goes, you'll see tomorrow. And from that night, he is the person. He made a switch as to what who his persona was.
Did you guys get along well because you both were baseball players?
No, you know what? I loved Brody all the time because he, since I've known him, he's been, I like honest.
Yeah, he's very honest.
I was drawn to that honesty, and he always kind of did that self-deprecating. You know, there was one night he brought a homeless dude on stage with him. He thought it was going to be funny, and then the dude went a little psycho and threatened to kill everybody in the audience. And Brody kind of snuck off stage and left this fucking psycho on stage by himself. But
it's like buying someone a fucking snake for Christmas.
Yeah.
All right, I'm out.
He was a homeless clown. He was like half made up and half not. And Brody was like, this dude's going to be. And then he just snuck off stage. And he was like, I think he's going to kill everybody. And
you know,
he just walked out.
It would be a fun podcast. I would like to do a podcast where I should have fucking done this. That maybe, someone start this podcast where you bring in comics and you do interviews with comics, but they're not allowed to tell stories about themselves. They're only allowed to tell stories about other comics.
That's awesome.
And then you piece all those stories together and you just release the Brody Stevens podcast, but it's all people telling stories about Brody Stevens.
By the way, there would be a lot of great Brody stories. Listen, he used to do a public access show with a buddy of mine named Tana Manu in Seattle.
Enjoy it.
Yeah. Jews and Samoans take over the world, and they had a little Jews and Samoans. And they used to have this transsexual named Rita O on, and Rita was this tiny little woman with this giant head. Whatever hormone she'd taken, the head just kept growing. And she would be at the Comedy Underground, and we'd be like, and she would eat like a fucking horse. Be like, Rita, can we get some of your nachos? No. And you would reach for them, and her voice would be like, no. But they loved having Rita on the show. I think Rita's head was so big, and maybe Joey or Brody could correct me on this, but I think she died because she took a tumble down the stairs because her head started to lean backwards and she couldn't stop herself.
Holy shit. Took
a backwards tumble down the stairs. I think that is what happened. But
Brody used to live like right down the street from
in New York?
No, in here.
Here?
Yeah, he lived right down the street from me. He lived like right up there.
Yeah.
And this was his Starbucks that he'd go to all the time. And so I'd always say like, hey man, if I'm having like a barbecue, I'm always just going to text you and please come over and hang out.
Yeah.
And he would come over, but Brody's so fucking the one time he did come over was like right before he kind of fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell something was going on, but it was like he's so interesting in the way in his interactions, and there were so many people that he came in and kind of walked back, put on my baseball glove, and kind of looked at things and said, and then threw some odd questions, grabbed a kettlebell, swung it around, and walked out. And everyone was like, what the fuck was up with him? And I was like, it's Brody.
He loves the kettlebell, dude.
He is so fucking fascinating.
Loves the kettlebell.
One of my favorite Brody stories is, I don't even know who told me this or how, or if I was there. I don't know. But a Montreal audition at the store or at the improv. And he goes up and tells his first joke for the audition, and it gets nothing. He goes, okay, clearly I'm not getting Montreal, but this is still a spot for me, people. And he goes, I'm still working on material. And he just does the rest of his set. Clearly, I'm not getting Montreal. The first time I ever saw him do stand-up was in the Lower East Side in New York. And he said, 10 Things I Hate About You is a popular movie. It's also from my diary. 10 Things I Hate About Me. I have hair on my cock. Not on the base, halfway up the shaft. I mean, I got so I obsessed with, like, I'd watch him in the back, and he was seamless. He seemed to make friends with everybody. He seemed to really make friends with people, and he was nice to me. No one was nice to me at that time.
Why not?
Because I look like I look. And
what do you think that means?
I mean, I look like a meathead, and I probably dressed like a meathead, and I'd go to these alternative comedy rooms in the Lower East Side where people were in, like, elf costumes, but for real in life. Like,
right. There's
a girl, Reverend Jen. She was very sweet to me. I mean, Reverend Jen is not who I'm talking about. But, like, Reverend Jen was wear elf ears, like, in earnest. I'm not shitting on the fact that she did it.
Right.
But, like, I remember coming out of Florida State, you didn't see people that really were that different. Like, people that really were genuinely outsiders finding a place that they could be themselves in.
Yeah.
And I was an insider going to an outsider's venue, and I don't know, maybe it was like, maybe I just had a look on my face of shock, and they saw that, and they were like, yeah, this fucking guy doesn't belong. But, like, I'd go in, and I'd bring, like, a fucking 40 and just sit and wait for my 5 minutes, and I'd try to do material that would work in a comedy club, but in these rooms, it just was like,
yeah,
did he talk about fisting a chick? Like, come on, man. We're fucking open-minded.
How do you feel about that? I read an article once where someone was describing my comedy, and I actually took this as a compliment, and my family was like, oh, I can't believe you said that. He called my comedy intelligently stupid.
Oh, yeah. That's a compliment.
Don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. I'm a big fan of Ernest Hemingway. Like,
yeah.
Ernest Hemingway was my guy. Like, and I'm not a big reader, but mostly because I think we found out I'm dyslexic. But I'm not a big reader, but I read all of Ernest Hemingway when I first moved to New York. And I read everything when I first moved to New York. F. Scott Fitzgerald, fucking Grapes of Wrath. I read everything when I first got to New York because I had failed a class in Florida State, and I needed to make it up and through correspondence. And so they sent me a box of books, and I had to read them all and write papers on all of them. And these were all the books. I'm very lucky that happened to me because I never would have read a fucking book in my life. The only book I had read up to that point was The Firm. I swear to God.
What an interesting choice, dude. You know what? If there's one book I'm going to read in my life, Grisham, The Firm.
Dude, my dog's named Abigail after Abby McDear. The fuck? I mean, look, I am dumb. Like, I am really a dumb person. Like, I haven't been tested and I won't be tested, right. But I think I am genuinely dyslexic. I know my audiobook, it's 5 hours. It took me fucking 16 hours to read out loud. It took me 16 hours in the studio to read it. And so, but I was at the SAE house at Florida and I was a freshman and we're all getting high. Someone's like, man, have you read The Firm? And I was like, you guys fucking read? And they were like, you haven't read The Firm? And I was like, no. And they're like, dude, it's a badass book. And some guy gave it to me, this older SAE. And I was an ATO pledge at Florida State, I think, at the time. Mm-hmm. Or just become a brother. And I got the book and I went home and I started reading The Firm. And I was like, I'd never read a fucking book. And I was like, holy shit, man, this is fun. Like, I'm laying in bed, flipping and going like, what happens next? Like, and I was like, oh, fuck yeah. And then I probably read another one of his books, but I don't think I did because I don't remember it. But I got a dog. I named it Abigail after Abby McDear. And I was like, The Firm was my fucking book. And when I heard it was becoming a movie, I could tell you where I was. I was in Boca Raton.
Stop
in
it.
A fucking hotel when someone's like, on the news, they were like, in John Grisham's book, The Firm is a movie. And I was like, oh, who's going to play? And they're like, Tom Cruise. I go, Tom Cruise, is it Mitch? Come on, man. Are you fucking kidding me? I was like, a literary. I was like, this is my book. I read this fucking thing. And then I moved to New York. I read all these books, and I was like, Ernest Hemingway is my guy because he doesn't put himself to be anything other than what he is, and he is, in a weird way, like, brilliantly stupid. Like, intelligently, whatever you
intelligently said, stupid.
I don't need to use big words to tell you what I'm thinking. I want to just use good analogies where you go, oh, that is fucking like,
yeah. Yeah, you know, I think there's a huge chunk of the population that doesn't necessarily want their comedy abstract.
I don't want to lose anybody, and I don't need to lose anybody. I want all segments of America to enjoy what I'm talking about.
But Bertie, it goes back to, look, that is your honesty, right?
Yeah.
If you tried to do something different, it would come across as you trying, right? That's the thing.
Yes.
There are
that
people
is
who
very
are that
brilliant.
There are people who are that smart that if they went on stage and talked like you and I, I'd be like, I don't buy that.
Yep.
I don't buy that at all.
You're very accurate in that, and that is why, and let me rephrase everything I said about Surf Reality and Collective Unconscious, or those clubs in Lower East Side, that is why I was not being genuine to me.
Yes.
I was trying to be them, and I was not them. I was not an outsider looking for a place to call my own. And there were some really fucking brilliant dudes. There's a guy, I don't know where he is in life, he had just gotten back from Japan, and he told literally a 10-minute story about the toilets in Japan. And I was on the floor howling laughing. I was laughing so fucking hard. And it was ultimately a shit joke.
Right.
And that was not who this guy was. He was a smart fucking dude. And I just went to Japan, and I thought about that guy in that room telling that joke as I took a shit. Every time I took a shit, I thought of that guy.
But you know what? At the end of the day, first of all,
That's Isla.
Great.
Jesus Christ.
At the end of the day, hilarious.
She's going to walk into a wall.
All I keep
bit.
Thinking about is what Joey said. I can't. That's.
Joey, she's fucking weird.
At the end of the day, first of all, you know when you said he's telling a shit joke and that wasn't him? I don't even like that. If it's a funny shit joke, it's a funny shit joke. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I will tell you, for me, my worst room in the country, the one that's hardest for me, is that Melrose Improv.
Oh, really?
For me, because when I go down there, I'm not like a hipster. That's not really my vibe.
Yeah.
And the shows that I've done down there have been kind of hip and cool. And it just hasn't, for me, that's always been my toughest room. I love the Comedy Store, the Laugh Factory. That Melrose Improv has always been tough for me.
I'm always oblivious to that. Definitely to the improv. I don't know. I don't do sets that much anymore lately. In the city, I feel like if I am doing a set, I'm going to hang out with people, and I'm getting fucking obliterated, and I don't give a fuck, and I'm so wasted on stage that it's just for me, that it's not for anyone else, it's just for me.
Do you tape those ever?
No. I don't tape anything.
Never?
Never.
You never tape, if you're working on a story, you never tape
the
story?
It's very short-sighted, but no. I should.
But how, because I'm assuming your memory is like mine, where sometimes you wake up and you go, wait, how did that go again?
Oh, yeah.
So you never tape your sets?
Never. I never do. You know what I was thinking about starting to do? I don't know if I'm going to say this and everyone's going to fucking go, definitely do that. And my manager's like, you're out of your fucking mind. I was thinking about starting to live stream all my shows.
Oh, boy. That's risky.
Just fucking live stream every fucking show.
You know why that's risky?
Why?
Because it's like when you try a joke and it's on the fucking net. And some you try a joke. Well, when that person and they tape it and they put it on YouTube, the people who are watching it don't know you're trying a joke, and all they know is there's a comedian telling a joke that's not funny, and this guy's not fucking funny.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate. I don't like people taping, and I've seen people recently. Someone was taping my set in Irvine in the front row. They were taping the whole thing. They had their phone and they were like this. I'm like. I know that you're fucking...
Did you say something to him?
Nah.
You didn't?
I don't... You know what I do in that? Honestly, I just kind of like... I didn't say anything. This is my new thought on life. If I don't see it, it's not real. So like, I don't... Like, I stopped reading like comments on Twitter a while ago. And then I was like, oh, I should read them. But then if I give the ones that are great... If they build me up, then the bad ones, I got to give them as much credit also. So I just stopped reading all comments for a while, and I was like, oh my God, I'm so much happier. I'm so much happier if I just put out energy. And then I was like, I'm going to stop checking for videos of me on YouTube.
I stopped a long time ago.
Because like, I would pull up a video, and it would be like, and I'd be like, oh my God, what the fuck? Like, oh shit, who taped that? Why did they tape that?
Yeah.
And then I was like, I'm going to just stop doing it altogether and just hope no one's Googling me. And maybe it'll be like...
Wait, like, did you stop reading your at mentions on Twitter?
I did.
That's powerful.
I read them a little bit. I posted a podcast with Jen Sturger. Do you know who Jen Sturger is? I went to Florida State. She went to Florida State. We both got famous at Florida State. And so I've always felt I had a connection with her. And I was, and when she got into comedy, I was really fascinated. And I was like, well, I've never been able to help anyone at Florida State ever.
Yeah.
I mean, no one is from Florida State in this business. So I was like, I'd like to have her on my podcast, see if she's like a real person. And if she's real, then let me see if I can, you know, help her out in some way. And she was very real. And we had a really good time on the podcast. It was really honest. But, and then I posted it and I was like, in my head, this is blowing my brain. I go, there are shitty men out there that are going to try to destroy her because she won't fuck them or because she's hot or whatever. Yeah. So I was like, I'm not reading any fucking at mentions at, for at least a week. So I haven't looked at anything for a week. And then I posted that picture with Omar last night.
Yeah.
Omar and Tone Bell and I were out. And I posted the picture and I was like, still not reading them. And that's what Omar's like, X-Pac mentioned me. And I was like, oh, fuck, I forgot I haven't looked at that. My wife will read the comments on fucking Instagram and lose her shit.
Oh, yeah, my wife, too. She's like, I'm going to. I go, don't play into it. I will tell you, I sent something out today, and I'm sorry I read the at mentions. I sent something out today just because of that, you know, what happened in Paris. And
no.
Oh, dude, so some, and I just was reading about it briefly on my way here, but some extremist Islamic extremist went into a place that does satirical cartoons and shot 12 people because they did something about Islam.
Holy shit.
Okay. So I sent them something out that just said, hey, that basically said, dear majority of people, of Muslims.
Yeah.
The majority, which I do know and believe, are not radical extremists.
Yeah.
It's just a dear majority of the Muslims in the world today. Your voices should be the loudest today.
Yeah.
And just like hashtag, like, let's stay together, which is basically, I know a lot of people.
There's nothing wrong with what you're saying.
What we're saying is, it's just like when there was perceived racism here in this country, white people, part of our jobs, the ones of us aren't racist, is to rally behind the people who are being, you know, basically murdered.
Yeah.
And to rally behind them and go, hey, we're with you on this.
Yes.
We stand behind you. Like, we're not saying that everybody, all white people are racist, but we're saying racism exists. We stand behind you.
Yes.
Right? So my thing was basically that. Like, I'm not saying that everybody who's a Muslim is a terrorist.
By no stretch of the means did you say that.
Right. What I'm saying is, hey, let's all stand together so the few see the many.
Yeah.
That's the key, is so the few can see the many, and then the people who are in the fringe can go, oh, I don't want to stand with the few. I'm going to go stand with the many.
Yeah.
Right? I made a mistake of reading some of the ads.
Ugh.
Did you just say, why should we have to stand up for the people, the few, you're racist? I was like, first of all, Islam is not a race. Just don't know if you guys understand that. It's a religion. So a religion just means it's a bunch of ideas.
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's all.
I used to love, one of my best friends is Jewish. Her name's Stacy. She was my director for Triflip season 1 and 2. And I used to love saying things to her that she knew that I knew was not right, but insisting that I believed it was right. Like, and I would always say that Jewish people were, that I go, you guys are a race. And she's like, no, it's a religion. And I go, no, you're right. It is a race. She's like, no, it's not a fucking race. It's a religion. And I go, agree to disagree. No, I can't agree to disagree. And I would do that all the fucking time. I miss her.
Agree to
disagree.
Funny as shit.
So yeah, but I see what you're saying. And it's, what's even worse than that is when someone agrees with you, but then in the wrong way. And it's like, yeah, all Muslims are horrible people. Good call, Josh. Yeah.
You're like, no, not at all what I said. Basically, what you're trying to say is, hey, let's all get together against bad shit.
Yeah.
But people, we've become such a reactionary group, right? Because the word.
So reactionary.
Right? So because the word Muslim is in there. Mm-hmm. It's just like if you told a joke that had the word retarded in it, even if the joke wasn't about retarded kids, even if it wasn't about retarded people, the word retarded would turn off certain people just because that word was in your joke.
Yep.
Right? Even though retarded is a legitimate word,
it is a real word that really means something.
Yes. It's like, not slang.
It's
it's not
it is an actual word.
Yes.
That is in the dictionary that does mean something.
Yeah, yeah.
That is, when they gave
It's a word.
It's been bastardized and hijacked. It's been commandeered.
But mentally retarded means exactly what it means. Mentally, you're a little retarded. Right? Like, it's not a slang. I'm not saying something bad about you. What I'm saying is the truth. Is that mentally, you're retarded.
I almost just passed out. Did you see that? I almost just passed out from laughing. It is a real word. That is so fucking hilarious.
So, but why are they giving us shit for saying mentally retarded?
That
you know what?
So hilarious because that you're, I fucking,
right?
It's so funny. It is in the dictionary. Like, it is a real word.
It means exactly what we're saying, that you're mentally retarded.
So fucking funny. I've never seen it that way. It's so funny because I'm on that other side of the fence where I've stopped saying it. My wife, by the way, I wish I could tell you this on air, but I don't want people to hate my wife, but she has the funniest fucking use of, but I've stopped saying it altogether, and I'm very sensitive to that word. So when she used it to me, right. I went, babe, you can't fucking say that. She's like, why not? I was like, because you can't, don't. And but I think because I'm a comic,
right.
I definitely figured out, like, okay, there are some buzzwords that maybe in history, I don't know where I want to stand in the sand on. And, you know, the N-word's a perfect example. I don't even sing it in songs anymore that have it in.
In the car by yourself?
In the car by myself. I don't even sing it.
You don't? In the car by yourself?
No. I haven't sung it in a car in easily
8 hours.
Well, no. I won't even listen to hip hop in the car with the girls anymore.
Yeah,
because the language is so coarse. But I haven't been in a car by myself in probably 4 years.
Get the fuck out of here!
I'm being serious. I haven't driven in forever.
You don't drive?
I stopped driving.
Those cars in the driveway.
Those are our cars, but I don't really drive. Well, I'm on the road all the time. Right. So when I am home, I'm always doing something with my family, right, and my wife always drives. I would venture to say I haven't.
Your wife drives?
All the time.
Is that just like, did you guys fall into that? Was it always that?
All the time. I have no idea, but she always drives.
My wife never drives.
I never drive. I here's the other thing, okay, I drove us to Irvine the other day. When we for New Year's Eve, I drove down, but my wife drove back.
What's the difference between you guys drive? Is it because she's just used to you having a couple cocktails, so she drives?
Maybe. She'll always drive home from a party.
Right.
And always drive home from dinner, because I will have a glass of wine or something. But yeah, I'm sure that has to do with why she drives. But if we went, like, we'll go to the movies tonight, she'll drive to the movies. She'll definitely drive to the movies. I don't know. My wife always drives. I don't... And when we're on the road, I've never driven a production vehicle ever on the road.
Well, no, I get that.
Yeah, so we'll go on the road. I never drive on the road. So I'll, for the next 3 weeks in Africa, I won't drive once.
Right.
And then I'll come home, and it's just so... You want to hear something crazy? We have two cars. The first car is the older Mercedes.
Yeah.
We haven't driven that in forever, and if I have a meeting, I take an Uber. I won't drive that car.
Let me ask, you're going to be gone for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm gone a lot too, traveling.
Why, do you want our families to move into the same house and we'll just share bills?
Yeah.
so badly. I want a compound so fucking bad. I want a compound so bad. I want
just a big family comedy compound.
Just a fucking, Rogan was talking about doing it in Santa Monica or in Santa Barbara. And I was like, by the way, I'm fucking in.
Yeah.
My wife's like, I'm not moving in with Ari, Duncan, Joey, and Joe and their families. I go, you have no idea how great it could be.
Yeah.
I was like, we could have horses. Like, this could change our lives.
Yeah.
And Joe was like, oh, I was just fucking around. I'm not really doing it. And I was like, yeah.
Me neither, but.
Me neither. I didn't think about selling my house. No, I didn't. I'll take it off the market.
It's weird that I pulled my kids out of school. That's not weird. Is that weird? That's not weird.
I got to get rid of this tattoo then. The Rogan compound tattoo. I mean, never mind. I want a compound so bad.
Do you feel like sometimes when you come home, and I feel this, that you actually are fucking up the flow of the house?
If my wife walks by right now, I'll bring her in here. I ruin this house.
Me too. I feel like I fuck up the flow of what they have planned and what they're doing. And I come home and I basically take the Etch-A-Sketch and I fucking shake it up to make it Josh's house again. But it hasn't been Josh's house for so long.
Dude, consistently feel like I step in, I'm stepping into a game of what's that, not hopscotch, but when they swing the rope, yeah. Double Dutch, that my family's in Double Dutch, and I just jump in like a big fucking elephant, like, the fucking game's ruined, asshole. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, we'll play again when he leaves. When he leaves, we'll play again.
I mean, to the point where it's like, especially when the girls are in school, because they're not in school right now, when the girls are in school, I just come in and just... It's like I cock block everything.
Yes.
It's like dad's still sleeping. He's not ready. Where's his wallet? Okay. His suitcase is in the middle of the floor. And yeah. I'm like, but I'm leaving in 2 days. Why am I going to put it in the backyard? Let me put it in here. There are little things like they now when I come home, only because I stay in so many hotels, they make me take my suitcases through the fucking driveway and then pull them out in the backyard because they're like, no, you're not going to put them in our house. You keep your shit. That's why we have this fucking man cave. I live out here.
My suitcase from San Francisco this weekend is not unpacked because I'm going to Sacramento.
Yeah.
And I just don't want to do it. That's not how I want to spend the time. But I completely fuck up the flow.
God, that is so fucking... I thought it was me because I'm a fuck up. But like, I completely fucking ruined the flow of our house.
I ruined the flow of like, my son will be like, hey, who ate that turkey?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I had a turkey sandwich. He's like, that's my turkey. Mom buys that for me. I'm like, but I'm not allowed to eat. And he's like, you're going to have to get your own fucking turkey.
I drank out of the milk carton yesterday. I goes, whoa, who does that? I go, I do. I go, this is my milk. And she goes, no, that's our milk. And we don't drink it. Now it's your milk. I go, in my head, I was like, wait, you guys don't drink out of the carton? And she goes, no, and because it's a house full of women.
Yeah.
Who the fuck comes in? I was like, oh, shit. And she's like, now it's your milk. Now mom needs to buy new milk because you drank that one. I was like, okay.
Do your kids ever treat you like you're not an adult and you're one of the kids?
Dude, yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Isla started calling me bruh. She walks in, she goes, what's up, bruh? I go, it's dad. It's dad. And she goes, sure thing, bruh. I go, Isla, you can't call me bruh. I am not a fucking parent in this house at all.
It happens to me every time I'm coming
so
home.
So fucking funny.
My son will walk right past me and ask my wife if he can do something. Hey, can I go over to Jackson's house? I'm like, I'm sitting right here. He's like, I know. Hey, cool if I go to Jackson's house? And then he'll just, because I'm gone, like I'll go out to go somewhere and my car will be gone. And I'll text him. I'm like, where's my fucking car? And he's like, I'm at Jackson's. I'm like, don't you... have to ask if you're gonna take my car. He's like, I always take your car. I'm like, but I'm home. And he's like, yeah. And I was like, what the fuck, dude?
I think that's fucking hilarious.
Let me tell you how little pull I have. I wish I could show this on. Can I show this to you?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. I was out of town. I had grounded my son, right? Because he did something I did not like. Now I grounded him, and then he posts this video. I ground him now. He's supposed to be grounded.
Okay.
He posts this video on Instagram. Just go ahead and press play there. That's him grounded. Now, by the way, you know when you see parties in movies, you're like, the parties like that don't exist.
Shut up.
Right?
I want to party with him.
I mean, right.
Wait, show that to the camera. Okay. Show that to the camera.
So...
here.
To walk up to it?
Yeah, walk up to it. Just put it right up to the camera. That's fucking... Okay. That's a great video.
Okay.
I want to fucking party like that.
Listen, the reason I know this video exists is because my buddy, when Instagram used to have a front page, my buddy from Philadelphia texts me. He goes, go to the front page of Instagram. You might see somebody you recognize.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Okay. This is how much clout I have as a parent. You're grounded!
And he just is like, oh, sure. Yeah. Enjoy Sacramento, Dad. Yeah.
Wait, so this was last year, 6 months ago. So I go to him. I come home. I go, hey, how was being grounded? He goes, oh, you know, it sucks. And I go, oh, yeah. I go, we'll just hang out. He goes, you know, we're grounded, then the laundry. And I go, you know, I have Instagram, right? And there was that long, you know, when a teenager lies to you, there's a long, like, pregnant pause. Because they're not ready to give up the lie.
Yeah.
They're just trying to think of a new one. Yeah. And he just stared at me. He goes, I might have stepped out for a couple minutes. And I go,
I stepped out for a couple minutes.
So I bust him, right? And he was like, yeah. And I go, did you not? He was like, I really didn't think you would check anything. And he goes, as long as we're being honest, I took your car too. And I go, what?
As long as we're being honest. Like, almost like he's letting you down,
but it's like,
gradually, yeah, like...
But he's like, he's my buddy. Like, he's, yeah, there's no fear in him telling me...
Oh, there's my kids have no fucking fear of me.
Nah.
None. Georgia's got a double ear infection. Not now, it's going away, but had double ear infection, pink eye. I definitely gave her the pink eye. I think I had pink eye. I think it just went away.
Right.
I had pink eye, but my eyes, well, one morning I woke up and they were sealed shut with mucus. And I was like, whoa. And I was like, what the fuck? And George is like, what is that? And I go, I don't know. And then she looked at it and she goes, oh my God. And I go, can you pick off the stuff on my eye? So she picked it all off and then she got pink eye. And my wife's like, how would Georgia get pink eye? I was like, ooh.
Let me, I don't know.
But so we had to give her eye drops. And she was, I mean, like panicking beyond belief about eye drops and ear drops and just like freaking out. And I did it the first time and I was like, listen, this is part of fucking, you're going to use eye drops. You're going to smoke weed. You will be using eye drops, yeah, in your life at one point. Trust me. I was like, but listen, it's not, doesn't, none of this hurts. Doesn't hurt. You need to get past that. And I got like frustrated with her. I was like, you're not feeling pain. I'm putting an eardrop in your ear. There's no pain involved. It's just uncomfortable, but it's no pain. I go, you got to get past that, Georgia. Right. And then she's crying. I go, stop fucking crying. I go, there's no. So I do it. I put them in and I go, see, it's over. You're fine. The next day, Leanne's like, we got to put the eye drops in. I go, I'll do it. And Georgia goes, no, I want Dad out of the room. And I went, you don't get to tell me to get out of the room. And Leanne goes, can you leave the room? You kind of freak her out. I go, no. I go, now that she said she wants me out of the room,
I have to be in.
I'm not only that, I got to give her the fucking eye drops. Yeah. And Leanne's like, for who? For you? Is this about you? Because she doesn't want you in the room. I don't want you in the room. You're the only one supposed to be in the room. I was like, yeah, but no one gets to tell me I don't get to be in the room. She goes, clearly Georgia does. And so I was like, fuck. And so and Georgia goes, Daddy, does it matter if you're in the room? The point is we need it done, and I don't want you in the room when it's being done. And I went, oh, fuck. So I just left. I was like, you fucking assholes. And but she got the drops and the ear drops and the eye drops. And
drama free.
Drama free. And I guess that's ultimately what matters. But I was like,
it's an interesting thing. You know, I think my kid's perspective on me is a little, it's a combination of responsible and not responsible. The responsible, in the back of their brain, they know if shit goes down because I took care of them by myself for so long,
yeah,
I'm capable. In the front of their brain, they're like, this dude has no fucking idea what's going on.
He's been very lucky up to this point.
Yeah.
His luck will run out one day.
I mean, I think they know, like, listen, when we were poor, I like I said, when shit goes down, you know, we used to eat breakfast, lunch, dinner at Ralph's. We used to just go and eat in Ralph's. We would eat the hot food, walk up and down the aisle. I'd put them in a cart. We would order hot food and we would eat it. And then we'd leave the cart at the end of the store and walk out. Like, we had no money.
Yeah.
We ate at Ralph's. So they know that shit. Like, I know how to do that. And push comes to shove and I'm going to figure out a way to make it through. Now, getting you to school on time every morning.
Scrapshoot.
Yeah. No. Now, my son, we looked at his report card, and at his first period class, his government class, in the first semester, he had 27 tardies.
I said to the girls, when Liam went to fucking London, and I was taking the girls, I go, guys, on time is subjective. I go, are you on time?
Yeah, who's, to
who,
what?
Who, and George is like, Dad, early is on time. I said, not really. I said,
What nerd told you that?
Yeah, Mom. Do you wish your kids had let me rephrase this. Do your kids have a perspective of being broke versus having money?
Yes.
Okay, my kids do not. They don't understand I don't think they understand. They don't remember.
Listen.
They don't remember being broke.
My kids, you know, not only a lot of that is in my book, and they've all read the book to kind of refresh it, but my kids were old enough, you know, to my oldest son especially eating at Ralph's. You know, they remember, my oldest son remembers, and we had this conversation. He goes, I think I remember you some days eating once. And I go, yeah, that was what we afforded. You guys ate three times and I ate once. And they remember living, you know. My oldest son, when we were living in that one bedroom, he was getting to the age. He was like, I want my own room. I was like, dude, this is the room. So I don't know what you're...
How did you fucking hold it together?
Well, he said, can I sleep in the closet? And he remembers that. Like, he would... You remember this closet, the sliding doors that have the mirrors and those crappy apartments in Hollywood?
Yeah.
He would sleep in one of the closets on the floor. That's where that was his room. So he has a definite memory of that and understands where
we are
now.
So walk me through timeline, if you can, your like so. Because I all of a sudden I was like, God, I want to know more about this story. So you marry this chick?
Never married her. You know, we met in Seattle and she had two kids and I dated her when she had the two kids. And then
and by the way, and this, maybe I don't know if this is something you don't enjoy talking about, but at the time, your cousin is fucking on TV.
Yeah. Party of Five.
Your cousin's like wealthy.
Arguably one of the biggest TV stars in the world at the time, because Party of Five was
arguably a guy that got. I honestly thought he was the heir apparent to fucking Tom Cruise.
Absolutely.
I sincerely believed that he was a fucking amazing. He still is an amazing actor, yep. I'm sure.
I think I bet you if you asked him, there were two movies that he chose.
Scott Wolf, for anyone Scott listening, who's like, who the fuck are you talking about? Scott Wolf.
There were two movies that he chose that I think we all would have chosen him too, were going to propel him into stardom. One, you remember the movie White Squall?
Yes.
Ridley Scott.
Shit, yes, I do. Okay. Fuck, that was a great fucking movie.
Great movie, had a great young cast.
That was a great fucking movie.
Great movie with a great young cast. For whatever reason, and I think that was one that everyone in this cast is being, because Ridley Scott killed it, great movie. It didn't do what people thought it was going to do for them.
Jeff Bridges?
Yes. Jeff Bridges? Yes, yeah. A great cast, dude. And
fucking, that's a
Balthazar
great movie.
Balthazar Getty. Yeah. Like, it was a young... All right, the second one was the sequel to what was a movie with Shirley MacLaine and Jack Nicholson, and it was really sad.
Yeah, Terms of Endearment.
So the sequel to that.
Yeah,
he was, and everyone was like, "Well, this is also two no brainers for him," and neither movie hit. And you know, in that business, especially movie, they'll give you a couple shots,
yeah,
and then they're gonna move on. And I think those two choices, which I think were great choices, just for you, it's a crapshoot.
Yeah.
They just didn't happen before.
Film is something that I've never really thrown my hat in the ring, but yeah. I think mostly out of like, I don't know if I could fucking deal with the rejection. Film rejection seems to be encompassing.
Yes.
It's like look at Gina fucking the bow and arrow lady. Gina
the bow and arrow lady?
Gina the fucking League of Their Own, the catcher.
Oh, Gina Davis.
Gina Davis.
Why the bow and arrow lady?
She's a competitive bow shooter.
She is?
She went to the Olympics for archery.
Do you know who's maybe the best crossbow user hunter in our world?
Who?
Is Jeff Foxworthy. World class.
Dude.
Bow hunter. World class bow hunter.
I should fucking... Rogan is slowly becoming a world class bow hunter.
Okay. Foxworthy, a buddy of mine, world class, won't use a rifle, and is an 100% hunter. Dude tracks like world class bow. Yeah.
That's not as surprising as if you had said Emo Phillips.
Yes.
Emo Phillips is a world
class. Him and Judy Tenuta go out.
Bow hunter. So go back to your story.
Oh. So where was I?
So you meet this chick.
We you know, she has two kids and we date for a little while and I really like the kids and she gets pregnant and I don't want that to derail me coming here. So I say, "Hey, we're all moving. I'm going to California. I want you and the kids and the unborn baby to come also." Mm-hmm. She said, "Perfect." Came down. We lived in an apartment in Hollywood and just didn't, for her, the LA lifestyle was dangerous,
yeah.
Plain and simple. And she got sucked into some shit she shouldn't have got sucked into. And you know, in my book, I will tell you this, people ask me why I don't.
What's the name of your book?
It Takes Balls, Dating Single Moms and Other Confessions from an Unprepared Single Dad. Okay. And I never badmouth her. And I refuse to badmouth her for a myriad of reasons. One being she is the mother of my kids.
Yeah.
So I don't think it does anybody any good to badmouth. I also, in my book, I'm not in the business of telling other people's dirty laundry.
Yeah.
I'm not a tell-all. I'll embarrass myself as much as you want. So she fell into some shit. But I still, to this day, good person, just...
You still know her?
Yep.
Okay.
And so... threw her out and just because the day I threw her out, honestly, was the first day that the kids woke up in the morning and didn't ask where she was. And as soon as they didn't ask where she was, I was like, well, if they don't care.
Yeah.
If they're so used to it now that they're not asking where's mom, then the charade is up.
What year is this?
98.
Okay. All right. Perfect.
98. So when I toss her, I got a one-year-old, a four-year-old, and a six-year-old. And I got to figure out how to do stand-up.
Shit, dude. And I don't think anyone really... I don't think...
How much money do you make, especially back then, doing a set at the Improv?
I'm $13, I think, or $35, yes. Whatever it is.
Right? So it was nothing. Same Comedy Store, Laugh Factory. So I'm not in town making money doing stand-up. I obviously can't go on the road. So it was a... I had to do two things. I had to find babysitters that would work for nothing. Joe Diaz.
Yeah.
And I had to find a job that I could do where I could bring the kids with me. Because you know how much daycare is.
Yeah. And that's all I'm obsessed with right now is that time in your life. You got a one-year-old, a four-year-old, and a six-year-old. Is that it? And the fucking... the doing that alone and being broke and trying to navigate Hollywood or Los Angeles isn't an approachable city.
No.
It's not a city where all this just falls in. I'm not saying that Tampa is, but Knoxville is a little easier to use. Even as a single parent with three kids, you can find...
Yes.
Knoxville is going to work easier for you than Los
Angeles. I'll tell you this. I lived in Hollywood at the time. There were times... I know this seems minuscule to people, but it's not in the grand... There were times, first of all, back then, there were no changing stations in the men's room, only women's room.
Yeah.
So I had to wait for someone to stand guard. I get yelled at all the time for coming out of women's room because I needed to change the diaper.
Yeah.
Two, this is not, especially back then, it's kind of cool to have kids now. It's changed.
It is definitely changed. You are 100% right about that.
I would tell you half of the restaurants I went to didn't have baby seats. So I couldn't eat there. It just wasn't on the radar of this town.
Yeah.
So it was a difficult city to navigate as somebody with kids. If I wanted to, you know, being broke, I went to IKEA every day. Do you know why? Because they would let me put the kids in the balls for an hour.
Yeah.
And I literally walked around it. That was my... time off every an hour a day. I would write with the kids in the balls at an IKEA desk at the IKEA store. I would sit down and just sit there with a notebook. And the guy who worked that section was like, "What's going on?" I was like, "Nothing." He's like, "Kids in the balls again today?" They knew me there because they knew an hour a day I would go drop the kids off for free babysitting.
That's those small cheats are fucking
huge.
Yeah,
dude. So what the business, and this is a chapter in my book, but the business that I ended up going with that I could do with them. I started my own peanut butter and jelly delivery service. So the people and we went out, we made menus. I walked around Hollywood in that area, went to all the businesses, handed out menus. And basically you would order peanut butter and jelly from me. It would have peanut butter and jelly, a Yoo-hoo, cookies and chips, and then a note from your mom. I would always write a note from your mom. And the note you could order would either be nice, semi-nice or spicy. Like the nice one would be like, "Hey, good luck in your math test today. Love, mom." Yeah. Semi-nice would be like, you know, you farted in your sleep or whatever. The third one would be like, "Your father and I are getting divorced. I think you're cute. Bring that weed under your bed. Let's have whatever.
Yeah.
I would fuck around. Just fucked up. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
And I did that with the kids. I would make the sandwiches at the house. They would pull the sandwiches with a red wagon, because what I found is they get better tips than I did.
Yeah.
So if I just sent the three of them in by themselves, my littlest one in the wagon holding the sandwich bags.
Holy shit.
If it was a $30 order, they got $30 in tips.
Yeah.
But we ended up going out of business because the health showed up at my door. They knocked at the door, right? And I opened the door, and my son opened the door. And actually, he goes, "Dad, it's for you." And I come out of the kitchen shirtless, peanut butter on my hands. My kids are on a blanket in the middle of my living room watching Blue's Clues, putting peanut butter and jelly sandwiches together. St. Bernard next to them. I used to have a St. Bernard.
Yeah.
This guy on a clipboard goes, "Is this PB&J's? And I go, "Yeah, but we don't do dine-in. We only do delivery. But go ahead." And he goes, no. He held up a clipboard. He goes, "I'm from the health board." And I go, "Oh." And I look down at my little sweatshop and three kids putting with some St. Bernard hair in there. 100% chance. And he goes, "You can't do this." I go, "I'll get the kids off the floor." He goes, "It's not the kids. You're shirtless.
making people sandwiches. I'm like, yeah. I don't want to get any peanut butter on my shirt for the deliveries. He was like, this is not good. And he goes, and you got a St. Bernard? There's hair all over the place. He goes, I told him, I go, there's not that much hair in the sandwiches. He goes, that much? There shouldn't be no hair in sandwiches. He shut me down that day.
Really?
He was like, if you bring out another sandwiches, I'm going to have to fine you. And they shut me down. But for a while, that's how we made. I did 200 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for 20th Century Fox. I did a showcase at the Improv. I did 200. That was the last thing we ever did. 200 sandwiches for 20th Century Fox. I did a comedy showcase. Of course, they didn't ask me to be in the showcase. They asked me to make sandwiches for the showcase. Just as good.
Sandwiches is show money
right now.
Same
thing. Show business. Yeah. Just get my foot in there. That was the last delivery we made. We made 200 sandwiches. We brought them to the Improv.
Really?
It was crazy.
So then, and you're still doing stand-up at the time.
Yeah.
And then I think being from Florida, I always use analogies of the water.
Yeah.
But like, when was the time where you got out of the surf and crested that one wave where you got outside the set? You just could breathe and be like, oh, okay.
I did a one-man show when they were still doing one-man shows, and that was the thing to do.
Yeah.
And I remember writing it. And my manager read it, and he was like, not funny enough. There's some funny, but not funny enough. And I told him, I go, you know what? As long as this isn't stand-up, and I'm not using a microphone and a mic stand, and it's in a theater, I'm going to go with my instinct, which is it doesn't have to be a stand-up show.
Yeah.
It has to be funny, but interesting. If I'm doing it in a theater, it's a theater piece in a way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I'm not going to go and try to make it a stand-up because I don't – that's not what I'm ready for. And so I wrote it out, and my manager was like, I'm going to hand this to a friend of mine who knows stories. And it was the guy who ended up winning Project Greenlight for the first year, a guy named Pete Jones.
Yeah.
And he read it, and he was like, this is exactly what you want to do in a space like this. I did it, got my first deal, and that was the first.
That was the first exhale. What year is this?
End of 99.
Okay. And then you did last Comic Standing.
Yeah, that was not a great experience for me.
I hated it. It was one of the worst things I ever did, and I didn't even go to the house.
I agree with you. I didn't like it. Made me wear a jacket and a collar and homogenized the entire situation.
My whole experience was they wanted to put you in a corner, and they wanted to put you in a box, and they wanted your box to fight other boxes.
Yes,
and I didn't like that, and I was like, no, that's not who I am, and I didn't enjoy the competition side of the stand-up, whereas I couldn't just fucking sit around and bullshit. Like, the cameras were on, and it was like, all of a sudden, everyone was fucking, like, talking shitty to each other. I don't know. I didn't like any of it. The only thing I liked out of it was I enjoyed watching Todd Glass, because he was so goddamn funny in every situation. I mean, like, we all flew out from L.A., and Todd Glass got the stewardess to say on the intercom, "Ladies and gentlemen, on the flight to this city, we would like to especially wish luck to Todd Glass." And no, all the people from LA are on this flight. All the fucking comics. There are probably 20 comics on this one flight. And he goes, "We'd like to especially wish luck to Todd Glass and only to Todd Glass for last comic stand."
That's brilliant.
It was brilliant. And then Todd got on the fucking mic on the flight home. And was like, he was so fucking geniusly funny in everything he did that I was like, if in my head, I was like, if I don't make it, I didn't.
Right.
I was like, at least, but you know what's so fucking interesting? And I can say this to you, I don't really say this to a lot of people, but there's that honesty shit, but like, I had just had Georgia. I'm sorry. Leanne was pregnant, and I had said that in the interview, I've got a kid coming, I'm not making any money. I was broke
right
at that time, and I was like, I need this. And then the fucking, I didn't make it that night. I didn't move on. And someone said to me, you know, man, fuck all this. You got a baby. That's what's important. I remember thinking, fuck that. I fucking kid, you really? I want this fucking show.
Yeah.
And I remember that I bought this little duck for Georgia at the place, the little gift shop at the hotel we were staying at. And I remember being begrudgingly like fucking, yeah, this kid. I was like, I'll get her a duck. And I remember being like, ugh, like I would have rather this show than this kid. I look back at that moment. I look back at that moment of buying that duck, and I almost am embarrassed that I wanted a TV show more than that. I couldn't respect how much joy this kid was going to bring me.
Yeah.
And I thought this TV show was almost more important.
But you know what is interesting is that as I don't know how to put this, as the comedy gets more honest, as and I consider right now in this business, what I love is podcasts or whatever. Everything blends in together, right? There's but as I get more honest and comfortable in my art, it becomes, I don't know if less important is the right word, but I know its place.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yep. It makes a lot of sense. I'm not as, I used to be urgent with comedy. I wanted.
Now.
I'm like, meh. Yeah. Like I literally did take and I feel like I'm still in it a little bit, but a sabbatical from my act because I had so much shit in there that was not conducive to me continuing creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And I had so much like blowjob.
But here's the thing. I don't put a big X on a blowjob joke, right?
Yeah, I don't either. However, they were jokes that I was not connected to personally. It was just a joke that I wrote that was funny and would kill and would destroy. And the laughter and the fucking showering of fucking watching people move around in their seats, I was addicted to that. And that for me is unhealthy.
Right.
So like I was just, and so I was like, all right, what do I don't know. I don't know. You know, I'm not certain. I'm like I said, I'm in this middle, this somewhat of a sabbatical of trying to figure out where, like I'm still doing shows, but I'm not. This last New Year's Eve was I snapped out of it and was like, all right, I need to get back on stage a lot. Right. And then I was like, I'm going to hit the road as soon as I get done the shooting. I'm going to hit the road and I'm going to hit the road hard and I'm going to do another hour. I'm going to do it I want to do it at the DC Improv at 11 a.m.
Is that your favorite club?
It's my favorite club in the country. Wow. And I love it. I know people listen to this. I love all clubs. I love a lot of the Funny Bones. I love the New Irvine Improv. It's fucking amazing. But the DC Improv, for me, is the first place I ever sold out, like sold tickets.
Uh-huh.
And it just reeks of a club that is just drenched in history. Like, it's so old, and it's got the weird fucking entrance to the thing. And
yeah.
It's such low ceilings. And
what about that Zanies in downtown Chicago?
Never been to Zanies.
What?
I've never been to Zanies. I heard that's a really good club, though. I do.
What do you mean?
I've never been to Zanies.
Because are you just strictly improv guys?
Ian Bagg and I were the first generation of comics. By the way, don't hold me to this. Anyone that's like, really, Bert? That doesn't sound like, sounds like this might be something you just made up. This is my narrative, everybody. It's the truth I want it to be.
I always say, dude, perception is reality. Whatever your perception is, that's fucking reality.
Ian Bagg and I were the first generation of comics when the improvs had now were in the process of expanding out.
Right.
But the talent was outweighing there was not enough talent to fill in the clubs.
Yeah.
And what they did, and once again, no one hold me to this, but Ian will say the same thing that I will say, is Ian and I were headlining when the improvs were expanding, but we were headlining a lot of the B clubs or alternative rooms that were not improvs.
Mm-hmm.
And we were headlining there, and they asked me and Ian to rescind on all our clubs that we worked on and just work improvs.
Right.
And we were the first generation that did that. Now I think that's kind of like,
there's a bunch.
It's commonplace. I don't even know what, but I remember Ian and I had to back out of clubs that we loved.
Dude,
and Ian and I did it together. And the best part of this was Georgia had just been born. And every club gave me a pass because they're like, look, Bert's got a family, but Ian, you have no fucking excuse.
Stop it.
And Ian was like,
stop it.
He called me. He goes, you motherfucker. He goes, I just got a phone with Pete on the Laugh Stop in Houston. In Houston.
Yeah.
And he goes, Pete just said to me, you're okay, but I'm fucking dead to him. He's like, because you had a fucking family. He goes, you fucking pulled out on him just like I did. And I was like, sorry. I don't even work with Houston Improv anymore. I stopped working Houston Improv.
Yeah.
But I fucking.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Ian and I were the first. I think that first generation of headliners, I can wrap my head around it. So like, we didn't have fame. Yeah. We didn't have anything behind us, but Aaron would give us, I want to say our offer was like $1,300. I'm guessing. I think it was $1,300 to headline, and you get 13 offers. And then it expanded like 22 offers.
Yeah.
But you couldn't really negotiate. There was no sellout bonus. And then the next year, like, the price lowered. And I remember calling Ian, and we'd piss and moan. And then the next year, it stayed there. And we were like, and they're like, well, the economy's in a bad spot, you know. Yeah. And so, but Ian, I remember that distinctly, and just being broke as fuck. And I remember Leanne going, you know, the math of this job doesn't work out. You get $1,300. We got to pay half of that to taxes. You're paying another 30% of that to agents and managers. You're only getting like $200 for flight insurance. And she's like, we're not making any money on this. I was like, it pays off. Don't worry.
In the end.
And Leanne was working a job. My wife, Leanne, was working a job. She ran an apartment building. And so she worked 40 hours a week as apartment manager in an office, raising two kids. I'm on the road. And I remember I came home one time, and the back of the toilet seat, the lid was broken in half. I went, what happened? She goes, I had a meltdown. I was like, what? She goes, don't worry about it. I had a meltdown. I literally think Leanne thought I was a fucking, that she married a chump.
Yeah.
Legitimately.
Hard to, look, because your 3 years of making $1,300 a weekend is the comedy equivalent of med school.
Yes.
That's the way I quit. So we still go to school, except our school isn't school. It looks like we're out fucking around.
It does. And then when we are home, we are fucking around.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so it's a really tough one, because when it looks like we're fucking around, we're not.
Yeah.
And when we're supposed to be home, not fucking around,
that's our time to fuck around.
Yeah, that's when we are. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But the med school thing, people don't get. They're like, well, how great was that? What?
Yeah.
It was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. I will tell you, the improvs for me have never been my best. Do you know the Dallas, the Addison Improv?
Yeah.
So they booked me there in September. And then whoever is in charge of the Addison Improv looked at the schedule and goes, oh, Josh Wolf? And they pulled my offer.
What?
He thinks I'm not ready to headline.
Hold on. Well,
He thinks I'm not.
I don't know what's going on with that club, because I know that they. I know that.
For whatever reason, the one club in the country that doesn't think I'm ready to headline, which is, I mean, at this point, I'm not going to bed losing sleep.
Yeah, you can't, yeah.
It's just super, it was very funny to me, that is the Addison Improv. The guy's just not, they pulled the offer.
That doesn't make sense to me, because I.
Is that, what would you do right now in your part, in your career? And for me, like, I try to go about things with very little ego, because I think ego doesn't generally end you up in good situations.
Ego's so fucking bad.
What would you do if say, Hilarity's in Cleveland, right?
Yeah.
They booked you, and then they pulled it, and you asked your agent why, and the guy was like, well, Hilarity's doesn't think you're ready to do an hour. What would you do?
Well, there's no way to not involve my ego. Because
exactly.
Because my ego, I mean, I can be honest, if you'd like, about ego. People that are listening to this, you may go, Bert, I've always liked you, but I didn't know this side of you. This makes me not like you.
Right.
I can't help it. That's part of me. My ego was in check. Like, my ego was wide awake and watching the front door of all the fucking, when I was in Cleveland and I went to Hilarity's and I walked in, I wanted to know if motherfuckers knew me. That's how fucked up my ego is. I was like, I'm walking into a comedy club, Mike Winfield's headlining, doing a week, and I went, my ego will be fucked up if when I get to the front door and say, hi, I'm a comedian, if I get fucking static, my ego's fucked up then. I go to the front door and I go, hey, I'm a comic, and I wanted you to stop in and see Mike. I'm shooting his TV show down the street.
Yeah.
And thank fucking God. The person working the door was like, no, I know who you are. Yeah. Bert, come on in. And I was like, thank God. If I got the call that said Hilarity's thought, and by the way, I don't know why we're talking about Hilarity.
Oh, it could be anything.
Yeah, because I don't play Hilarity. Yeah. I don't. And so clearly they don't think I'm ready to headline.
By the way, Hilarity's a great club.
They were very nice when I went to hang out with Mike. And they actually said, do you want to get on stage? And I was like, no. And I was like, I'm fucking already drunk.
Right.
And so, and Hilarity's is a really cool room. But, I might spiral out a tad bit.
I have to tell you, it was an interesting, and I don't even, my agent would hate me if he knew I was talking about this, because he's like, you're going to ruin a relationship. What relationship? They obviously clearly think I'm fucking terrible anyways, but it was a tough pill for me to swallow, man.
So interesting. The Dallas Improv hasn't worked me in like a fucking couple years. I wonder if they think.
Is that true?
Yeah. I used to work the Dallas Improv every fucking year. And then, you know, and then I did some, I've not been the best businessman with my career in comedy, is that I've bailed on a lot of gigs for TV. I've bailed on a lot of gigs for TV, and I would hope, I've always hoped
people
clubs,
understand that. They understand.
I'd always hope clubs would understand that, but then I think some clubs go, well, I don't know if I want to put you on the calendar because I feel like you're going to cancel anyway.
Yeah.
So in which case I just go, I totally get that.
Yep.
But, and I got to earn that respect back from you, but, I don't know. I don't want to speak out of school, but I know they had some issues go down at the Dallas Addison Improv. So, some
pretty changes.
Some pretty sincere stuff go down there.
Yeah.
And one of the, I think when it went down was one of my friends who was the owner of the club. I don't know what happened. But I know that my guy that I used to love being around, Trey,
not there,
is not there anymore. And I don't know how that went happened or what that happened, but I loved Trey. But I used to work the club all the time. I haven't worked there forever. They haven't had me back.
Maybe they have. Maybe in the manager's office there's a picture of me and you.
There is a picture of me there. I guarantee it, but I bet it's been taken down. Because I used to put pictures of me up and then sign them from Trey, like to Trey, and I'd make ridiculous statements claiming that he had said them. Like, I really appreciate all the words about me being the next heir apparent to Comedy Central. Thank you so much. And then hoping other comics would see that and go, Trey, why'd you say that about him? He's not even that funny. I haven't worked Addison Improv in a while.
I think they hate us. Do you know one of my favorite things to do with the...
Hey, Addison Improv, if you're listening, Josh and I will co-headline
on
a sold-out night.
Come down.
I guarantee we'll sell the fucking place out. I guarantee fuck it to you.
100%.
Oh, 100%. Addison Improv. Let's bury this hatchet.
Yeah.
Josh and I will come down.
Together.
We'll do one night. We'll do an off night. We'll do like a Wednesday night.
Wednesday night.
We'll co-headline.
Mm-hmm.
And I guarantee you we'll sell it out. I know my numbers from this podcast in Texas are fucking through the roof. I don't work anywhere in Texas now that I think about this.
You don't do Cap City?
No.
You don't do Cap City in Austin?
I did Cap City once. God damn it.
Fucking, dude, Cap City is amazing.
I did Cap City once. I had a really great time. But the radio station, Bob and Dudley, one of the guys doesn't like me, and so they wouldn't have me on. And quite honestly, I don't blame Cap City, but they were like, that's kind of our meat and potatoes.
Right.
We put comics on there, and that's how they sell tickets. And Joey and Texas is a big podcast. It's a big desk squad area.
Yeah.
It's a massive desk squad area. And so Joey is big at Cap City.
Yep.
Buns is big at Cap City. Fucking Ari and Dunk. Everyone. Joe. And I don't know. For some reason, one guy just doesn't like me. I don't know the guy's name, but the club told me, they're like, the guy doesn't like you. He doesn't want to have you on. And we can't really sell tickets if no one knows you're here.
Right.
And that's how we get people to know you're here. So
that's a bummer.
Yeah.
Cap City's a good club.
It's a great club. I did it one time. I really liked it. I really